Motopod, proudly supported by Roadskin, a UK label specializing in protective outerwear for motorcyclists. Modern biker clothing that you can wear all day long and engineered to save your skin. For the road, for life, visit roadskin.co.uk. Welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 813, recording on August 27th, 2025. We're going to talk about the race from Hungary at Balaton Park. And when I say we, I mean me, Jim McDowell, your host, and my cohort in all this, partner in crime, if you will, Richard Jowett. Richard, a good afternoon. No, good evening to you. It's a good afternoon here.
Yes.
Forget where I am and what time zone because work is just that hectic. But anyway, we survived Hungary.
Yes. It wasn't a set of barnstorming races, but we're going to get to that. But lots to talk about, nevertheless, and quite a bit of news to crack through as well, Jim.
Yeah, there's quite a lot here. So let's just kind of get to it. Hey, you know, if you guys can subscribe to the show, throw some money in the pot, we'd be greatly appreciated. You can do that by going to our website, www.motopodcast.com. Anything helps. But if you can't do that, hey, leave us a review wherever you get your podcast from. That will help as well. Hey, tell your friends about us. Share us on social media. Talk to your friends at the bar. Just go up to people who have a bike shirt on or a racing shirt on and say, hey, did you ever hear of these guys? So any of that would be really cool. I mean, I think Rich and I think we've got stories to tell about just seeing people out and about and, you know, introducing them to the show and, you know, they're listeners now. So if you guys could do that, help us out, be really appreciated. With all that, a big thank you to everybody who's helping the show out, and especially to everybody who wrote in this week. There's just a ton of email that flew in.
Weeks of nothing, and then suddenly we get like four or five.
Yeah, everything shows up at once, right? So we'll start this email with former host Martin Darlington's emails that flew around. The one I'm taking from this one, Rich, there was some argument about Hungary and everything else, but we'll save that for later. But it was Martin had a statistic, if I have this correct, that there is a lack of champion slash winning riders that are in the MotoGP class. Was that a fair summation to what Martin said?
I think so. I must admit, I wasn't getting all of these emails for some reason. I haven't mentioned that to you, so I need to dig into why that is. So I'm kind of catching up a little bit. But anyway, crack on, and we'll get into the meat of it.
That was the biggest point was that Martin had come up with some statistic that, you know, if you look at who's on the grid now, how many of the guys that are on the grid are race winners, and you start thinking about it, he's right. There's not really Marquez, Alex, Bastianini, Pecco. But then it's like after that, Mir, I guess, you know, and Zarco this year, but there aren't many. For a 22 rider grid,
yeah,
there is not a lot of that, let alone that, you know, Mark is one who's won titles in all three classes. And then you've got some, but in the MotoGP classes, anybody else got titles? You know, I mean, Mir does, right? You know, there's a title there, but Pecco's got a couple titles. Quartararo's got a title. But I think after that, I'm hard pressed to come up with who I'm missing who potentially is a world champion. There's obviously a couple there.
Yeah. But I think, I'm just quickly reading through it again. I think what Martin's pointing out is what I suppose you would call a bit of a paradox, which is that of the current MotoGP crop, a lot of them haven't won a title. Whereas if you go back, I guess he's talking back about 10 years or so. I think he pointed out that only Karel Abraham and Aleix Espargaró in the season that Martin was recalling hadn't. So, and yet we kind of think of that as a less competitive time. So it's a little bit kind of weird at the moment. So is it because you just get one or two people that win a lot?
Maybe. My thought was, and this is the kind of the corner of this, is that to me, what I thought the data represented was that a good rider with money will be a MotoGP rider for as long as the money continues to arrive, whereas a great rider without money will not be a MotoGP racer. That's how I saw it. Again, opinions or whatever. But you either have to be an ungodly talent to be there at MotoGP, or you better be bringing along a good sum of money to help you get there. Now, every one of those guys that's riding a motorcycle at that level is extremely good. There is no question about that. It's just that there are the, we talked about this before, Rich, there's the aliens, right? Well, how many people are aliens right now? If you look at it right now, there's only one alien on the on in the class. That's Marquez himself, Mark, right? To
Yeah,
me,
with a couple of others that are hinting at the fact that
close.
they are going to be the next kind of generational aliens in the
Correct.
class. Yeah.
Acostas is sort of the alien in waiting. I think Aldeguer is alien in waiting. But I think also, I think Martin maybe said this in his email too. Again, I don't have the email in front of me and haven't read it for a couple of days. But like Bagnaia, is he an alien? He has two MotoGP world titles. He's a good, great rider, but he's the alien territory? I don't think he is. He's kind of like Dovi, a thinking rider. Again, if Mark didn't have a good motorcycle, didn't have an injury or whatever, would Dovi have won titles? Probably. But Mark had a dominant bike and was able to ride around and didn't really have any injuries either, right? So he could ride a bike better than what Dovi could, or was maybe more willing to risk everything to win, as opposed to Dovi's more strategic thinking kind of concept that was going on. So anyway, that I thought,
I have a theory, just thinking about this a little bit more. So I think the thing that has changed, and I think which underlines the point that Martin is making, which is that there were more champions from other classes on the way up to MotoGP, say 10 years ago, and there are less of those now. I think the thing that's changed is that of those champions, say that they had won a championship in Supersport or in Moto 2 or 250 as it might have been then, more often than not, they were not arriving on top machinery. I think we have to remind ourselves that 2025 level MotoGP machinery is pretty well. I know there are differences between the brands, obviously. So if you're on Pramac Yamaha, you've got the same machine as Quartararo effectively, but the Yamaha is several steps behind the Ducati and the Aprilia, let's say. So accepting that there's always competitive differences between the brands, nevertheless, I think all of the riders in MotoGP now are on very competitive and equal machinery, allowing for the slight gaps in performance. And I think that's the difference now. So I think you can not be a champion in a lower class or in another series and come across the MotoGP, but still not necessarily. Well, I don't know. I mean, are you following my train of thought there?
I think so. I think I see where you're going.
I think it's easy to show flashes of brilliance in MotoGP now because you like to be on a good bike. Whereas before, if you were on kind of hand-me-down stuff or Tru's kind of satellite, think what we often talk about Tech 3 Yamaha, don't we? And they were properly customer bikes. I mean, they were probably 1 or 2 years out of date compared to what was the works machines at those times. So even if you were a Colin Edwards on it, for example, as world superbike champion, you were unlikely to win any races, and indeed he didn't. And he was on works machinery as well, but at various points in his
Yeah.
career in MotoGP.
I
So
think a fair, sorry to interrupt you there, Rich, but the fair comparison of that would be Ben Spies on a Tech 3.
yep,
Ben Spies
or
was
Cal Crutchlow.
all kinds of AMA titles, right? And then went to World Superbike in 2000, 2009 on a Yamaha and completely obliterated everybody in World Superbike, wins that title, jumps to MotoGP. But there was the rookie rule that said that a rookie couldn't be on a factory team. He had to be on a satellite team, hence he's on Tech 3, wasn't even close to winning, but then showed up on the factory Yamaha and won a race. But he had the bad shoulder injuries and all that. Of course, that rookie rule got rescinded because Honda had a guy that they wanted to have on their bike as a rookie. And well, whatever H wants, H gets. So, anyway.
I was going to
But
remind you of that. I'm glad you picked
oh
it up.
no, you don't have to remind me of that
Yeah,
at all.
somebody got a leg up there. Could it be a nationality thing with Dort? Who knows?
Who knows?
Had he toiled away on a satellite bike for a year or two, I'm sure he would have still raised eyebrows and got to where he eventually got to, but it might have taken a bit longer.
Yeah, well, if he would have spent a couple of years on a satellite bike, he wouldn't have been the youngest. No, he's not the youngest race winner anymore, is he? I thought somebody who took the. No, Acosta could have taken it, but
But
didn't,
didn't,
right?
yeah.
That, okay.
I think that's what it was.
Sorry, I think that's where it is. I could be wrong, but that's off the top of my head. But you get the point. He wouldn't have been a world champion in his rookie year
Yeah.
if he wasn't allowed to be on that factory bike anyway.
Just to finish this point, I'm kind of curious now about what Jorge Martin does, because my appreciation for him is going up a bit, despite, bearing in mind I've always been a bit down on him as a character. We saw glimpses of what's to come, I think, at this race at Balaton Park last weekend, as he starts to regain his fitness and get some form on the bike, as he gets to learn it a little bit more. Now, my question for the future is, will he prove to be an alien? Because, okay, he beat Pecco last year, just lost out to him the year before. So that's a bit of a. It's not really the comparison we want to see at the moment, is it? But he can actually start taking the fight to Marc Marquez as the year goes on, and as we go into next year, because we know Martin's going to stay on the Aprilia next year after all the contractual shenanigans. If he can start to beat Marc a bit, then I think that we start to have that conversation about Jorge Martin as well, because credit is due there if that's what he starts to do. And I think that will, in my eyes at least, elevate him significantly from the fact that he beat Pecco last year. Because, like you, I do class Pecco, as, and as Martin said, as more of a Dovi kind of character. Very good, but on the best bike. A very intelligent rider, but we're seeing him hitting a bit of a stop this year, as he can't get around whatever the issues are that he's got. And it's actually raised this, you've probably heard it on some other podcasts, it's actually raised this concern that are Ducati in danger now of going down the HRC route, which is because they got Marc Marquez on the bike and there might be some issues with the 25, which the other riders on it can't surmount. Are they going to go down a blind alley if they're not careful? I mean, technically it doesn't really matter because these bikes are gone in a year and a half. So, but if it influences the 27 bike in some way, are they at risk? I mean, that's a big question mark to put out there for another day, perhaps. But although I'm sure you've got an opinion on that.
I've never been warm to Jorge Martin. I am starting to warm slightly. I have no way to defend anything that he said has done or the shenanigans he and his manager have tried to enact to get out of a contract.
Yeah.
I'm
No,
sorry,
I'm
that's
talking purely on
well,
track. Yeah.
so I want to
Yeah.
just make it I was just trying to make it clear that like I in no way appreciate anything that he's done in that respect. However, if we
Agreed.
talk about what he has done recently on an Aprilia and a small sample size of one here at Balaton, right? And you have to, I've got to say, if he is the man to then bring the fight to a Marc Marquez on a different motorcycle, well, then that is a interesting concept to me, because if I think we, I don't know if we would all agree, but I think we all got to think that Marc is the best of his generation. And he is definitely on a playing field that's different than almost everybody else in MotoGP right now.
Yeah.
And you can say, well, Quartararo has the talent. Well, he doesn't have the bike. If Quartararo was on another bike, would he have it? Well, here you're seeing the question asked of Martin, would he be as good as Marc on a different bike? And there are glimmers of hope that he is going to be as good as Marc on a different bike. Now, a lot of that hinges on Aprilia and what they do. And there's a lot there with that, but I am warming to that idea.
Yeah, I think that's what we're going to either see or not see as this year goes on. I think I said in the last episode, I can see a podium before the end of the year. I think a win is obviously going to be incredibly difficult because we just don't know how much extra Marc Marquez has got in his pocket, really. He has crashed whilst pushing too hard, but that was tended to be early on in races or in sketchy conditions. We haven't really seen him very, very hard pushed. Yes, he's been pushed by his brother, but I do conscribe to this kind of notion that I don't think Alex is sending it to his brother like he sends it to other people. I just think that's clearly demonstrated by some of the moves he's made on other riders this year. It's a bit controversial, a bit unkind, I suppose, but I think it's true.
Yeah, I do. So this kind of all dovetails in nicely to Gareth from Australia and his email, and he said, "Hey, MotoGP is boring. Is it boring, Rich?"
It depends how you want to define what you're watching, I think. I mean, I remember having this conversation. I know you don't really watch a lot of World Superbike, but this came up a couple of seasons ago with Bautista in World Superbike, where he was just winning everything. And you can say it's a bit of a lame ass excuse, but I kind of take the view that you just have to appreciate how good somebody is and just marvel at what they're doing, even if they are largely doing it on their own out on track, because it won't last forever, because nothing ever does. And we've seen this with Marc Marquez before. Things can change very, very quickly, and then the whole thing gets shaken up. Not to say that we want Marc Marquez to get injured or anything, but things can change very, very quickly. And I think, in a way, what kind of frustrates me and what has made it a bit boring is, as we were just saying, the fact that Martin got so badly injured. And I think by the end of the season, we will start to see the sort of season we could have had had it not been for those injuries and some of the other distractions that have crept in along the way. So, is it boring in terms of action out front? Yeah, I think it is. But then you get like in Austria where you had Aldegar storming through. Wasn't he going to catch Mark? In the end, he didn't. And Mark probably would have had it covered anyway at this point in time. There are what's really super interesting to me, and I think we're going to have a much better. Are we in the last half of the championship? We are now, aren't we?
Yes.
I can't think how many rounds we've got to go. I think you've got KTM clearly making strides forward now. Martin coming on song to sort of go forward with Bez, who's already there. And well, that's probably the main interest point, isn't it? Is those two things, because Acosta, as we've said, will definitely be there if the bike is there for him. And we're starting to see that that's coming together, as well as with Bastianini and Vinales before he got hurt and so on. So I think there are signs that it won't be as tedious out front in the second half of the season as it's been in the first. So has it been boring? Yeah. But I appreciate the fact that we're watching, a real goat. And again, I've never been that bigger kind of flag waver for Marc Marquez. But ever since he decided to change brands, I always admire that in a rider, because I think you take that risk, you put your legacy in jeopardy a little bit. Because if it doesn't work, people think, well, he was only winning because he was on a Honda. Whereas we're actually really seeing the class that the guy's got. And let's be honest, he's politically kind of maneuvered and economically, because bearing in mind the pay cut he took for a year, he didn't earn anything at Gresini last year. I know he doesn't need the money, but nevertheless, he took a big risk to get to maneuver himself into the position that he's in now. So, you have to admire that, I think. And again, to me, that off track part of him just amplifies that level of greatness that he's got, because he's got that swagger. He can just do it in the way that Rossi was like that. I don't know that Rossi, for me, is kind of the greatest of all time. I think that's a debate which is very hard to have, because I would put Lawson in there because he did the same thing switching bike manufacturers. Kenny Roberts has got to be in that conversation. You go prior to that, and then you're getting into such a different world, like with Agostini and stuff, where he would win a race by 5 minutes. So you can't compare it. I mean, you can't really compare the 80s to now, but you take my point. It's hard to have that debate, isn't it? But Mark is on another level at the minute. And is he making it boring? I guess he is a little bit, Gareth. Yeah, but it's a great point that you make, and we appreciate the email as always.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about goats, like of all time, Freddie Spencer for me, the man won a 250 and a 500 title in the same year. In a time when the style of riding for a 500 was 180 degrees different than it was on 250, and that was the first time Honda had ever made a 250, and he wins it. Okay, so that's there. I told Gareth in my longish reply back is that look. What Marc Marquez is doing right now is transcending sport. There are people who have not talked about motorcycle racing or know nothing about motorcycle racing that have come to me and say, "Hey, what's with this Marc Marquez guy having basically almost ripped his arm off and he's winning races again?" And this is what Liberty is going to do. They're going to market that, right? And we're going to have people come to the sport who weren't in the sport before because of this story that's being created. So it's maybe we have to deal with this to have a greater good on the backside. Plus, I said in my reply was, "Hey, look, I think when we saw Marquez go to Ducati to face the defending or a two-time world champion on the bike, i.e., one Pecco Bagnaia, I think all of us thought, or all of us who are old enough to think this, thought, oh, Prost versus Senna at McLaren, and we did not get that battle. We have been robbed of it for whatever reason." And we sort of got a Verstappen versus Checo, where the one guy just dominates the crap out of the other guy, and that's where we are, right? I mean, Gareth does take into consideration, I'm not really a Cole Market fan, but I understand his talent. He gets all that too. But it was a great thought experiment, I thought. I thought it was a great letter, Gareth. I thought it was really, really interesting. It was a lot of back and forth that was there. And as Gareth said, one Bezeki saved MotoGP this weekend. We'll get to that, right? But it was a great email. I appreciated it very much, Gareth.
Yep.
Well, then, okay. Well, all right. Jacob Rauer, calls in, writes in, it's like, yeah, I don't realize that Texas is not as big as all of Europe. Yeah, okay, I did. It was tongue in cheek, kind of. Okay, I know Texas isn't as big as Europe, but it's about as big as the Iberian Peninsula, France, Italy, and Germany, and a little bit of Australia. It's about that big. So it's a good chunk. It is a state that is a good chunk of the landmass that you consider to be
I think we
Europe.
should just stay off geography,
I think
full
we have
stop.
to. I'm it.
After the
That's it.
last
I'm
couple of
done
weeks.
with geography. Again, my perception of what's where because of the Iron Curtain is being gone now messes everything up. But yes, I did misspeak. I did get it out of whack. And technically, for all of you who really want to know, because I looked it up, is that the size of Texas is 15% the size of Europe, which includes your Scandinavian countries. Italy and a good the Eastern countries and a good chunk of what is called Russia, because it goes all the way to the Ural Mountains, which is defined as the separation between Europe and Asia. That I looked up, so I know I'm right.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, fair enough, we're done. That's it. No more. Right. And then we've had Scott Baldwin had a great little find. It was Casey Stoner's quote on the new rules, where he's saying, look, you're not going to fix anything with the rules that you came up with. And I think Casey was lamenting the fact that you got to get rid of all of the wings and you need to put everything into the hands of the rider. And I am not going to sit here and tell you that Casey Stoner is wrong, because he very well could be right. But what I am going to hang my hat on for a minute is the fact that, look, the trash control is basically gone. The ride height devices are gone. Hole shot devices are gone. The bikes are going to have one geometry, and that geometry is all you're going to get. So you're going to have smallish wings on there, circa like 2015, 2016 kind of wings, if you will, that sprouted out then. And I don't think the racing was bad then. So I think it's potentially going to go back to that. But, somewhere, some way, and I think this has been is a the bigger talking point to all this, is that the speed of the bikes have to be slowed down significantly. I think we are flirting with danger here yet again, and it's a danger area that we don't want to get to. Again, I would be just as entertained, and you can chime in on this, Richie, if you want. If you put the entire MotoGP grid on a set of mopeds or 50cc Groms or whatever, and had them go race that, it would be just as entertaining to me. I wouldn't care. That doesn't matter that they're doing 210 miles an hour on a straightaway. I could not care less.
We tune in for the competition, and we tune in for the people that we support, or the teams that we support, the characters. That's kind of the essence of sport. I mean, when you talk about people that transcend the sport, that is what made Muhammad Ali great. Michael
Right.
Jordan, if basketball is your thing, Tiger Woods, you name your sport, there are plenty that you could pick out that they become household names. So that's all part and parcel of the sporting spectacle, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, interestingly, Jim, on your reply back as part of the Gareth Locke email chain, you wrote, "The best we can hope for is that the new rules will produce better racing." And I think where, in my opinion, where Casey Stoner is kind of missing the point a little bit is that it doesn't matter what the rules are. I mean, yes, obviously the focus needs to be to slow the bikes down a bit. Whether they will achieve that, of course, is open to debate, because they might be faster in other ways.
Carbon fiber brakes have to go. If you want to slow them down, I think that you got to go to that.
Parking
But
that to one side a moment, though, I mean, the truism throughout most of motorsport is that it doesn't matter what the rules are, there will generally be one team or manufacturer that kind of get it better. So you can make the argument that it doesn't make the racing better. It will if you have a Prost and a Senna in the same team. You'll just have the two guys on the same car or the same bike that are competing against each other. And obviously that is not what we've got in the Ducati squad this year with Marc Marquez, although we hoped that it would be different. It's very unusual to have seasons or prolonged periods of time where different riders and different brands kind of consistently win. It has happened. but it's sort of vanishingly rare compared to the sort of the domination you'll get from one brand or team for a period of time until something changes and then somebody else gets it right. So will Honda come out with an 850 that is kind of like the RCV 211V in 2002? They could do. And then we'll be moaning about the fact that Joan Mir's walking the title. I say tongue in cheek because I'm a bit of a Mir fan. You know, who knows? Who knows?
Who
But
knows?
point well made. But yeah, I think Casey can sort of be Casey Stoner-ish or Stacey Moaner-ish about these things. And it won't really change that basic fundamental fact of motorsport because it's, you just look at history. It's always how it goes.
Oof, with all that good and great listener feedback,
Yes,
Dom.
thank you, everybody.
Keep
Brilliant.
writing in, guys. This is the part of the show I enjoy the most is that interaction and talking about different things that you see that I don't see or Rich doesn't see either for that matter. But let's get on to the news, Rich, shall we? Okay, so first thing here, Gonzalez will stay at the Intact Moto2 team for 2026. Now, the rumor was flying around in Hungary that he was in play at Yamaha again, but apparently there's no room at the inn, so Gonzalez stays in their Moto2 for yet another year and will then get his shot, I guess, in the 2027 season,
Well, Willie,
perhaps.
though, I mean, that's
I don't know.
again, I watched the TNT coverage, as I've said many times, as of this year. So I don't know what Lewis Sutterby and Matt Burt were saying on the Dorna feed that you'll have been watching, Jim, but they were making the point that because Gonzalez came through the Supersport avenue and then jumped across to the Grand Prix paddock, he's taken quite a long time to get to this point. And as well as he's doing this year, and he's obviously doing bloody well, there are younger people coming up faster. A David Alonso will be ahead of Gonzalez in the MotoGP 2027 kind of draft picks, if you want to use an Americanism. I would suspect, even than Gonzalez, even if Gonzalez is the Moto2 world champion, I just fear that's a sad fact of the way things are. Aaron Canet is another example of a guy that, you could make the argument that he should have had a shot at MotoGP, but he's been in Moto2 for far too long, or hanging around in the lower middle class area of the sport for far too long. So I feel a bit sorry for Gonzalez because couple of months ago he was having a MotoGP test on the track house Aprilia, did pretty well, and all of a sudden, two things have conspired against him. Diogo Moreira has popped up to be the rider that everybody was waiting for him to be, and Yamaha are definitely going to be racing their V4, and therefore they need Jack Miller in the team, and it looks like that is what's going to happen next year, that Jack Miller will stay put because they need his experience and technical know-how from having ridden for multiple other teams. And so that kind of rules Gonzalez out, really. I think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, I see your point. I see your side. I get everything that you said there. I look at it slightly differently. I think that you have to do something with your own racing talent slash desire win, whatever, to make it such an outstanding season that you have to be on a MotoGP bike, right?
Yeah, I
You
agree.
because I look back a little bit, you think of how great was Acosta's season in Moto3 that he then went to Moto2, right? How great was Alonso's season in Moto3 and he is now in Moto2. Look at how great Acosta's second season of Moto2 was and where was he after that in MotoGP. You don't think Alonso is going to not have a absolutely phenomenal Moto2 season in 2026 and will be in a team on a MotoGP bike in 2027 because there's something special about those people. That not that Gonzalez isn't special, okay? He's not the special kind of special.
Yeah, it's star quality, isn't it?
Yeah, it's star quality,
That's what
right?
it is. Yeah.
I mean, you could think of it from the standpoint of like the first time you use this golf analogy. First time you saw Tiger Woods play, you're like, "Jeez, old Pete, that's something amazing." The first time you saw Michael Jordan play basketball in the NBA, you're like, "Wow, where did he come from?" That's what you see in Acosta. It's what you see in Alonso. It's what you saw in Marc Marquez back in the day, right?
Yeah. I think I said, didn't
Fair.
I, last time out, indeed, in the last episode, I think it was. I was kind of saying, and it's an intangible thing, and it's very unfair to somebody like Gonzalez, but I think I said he goes about it in a very sort of methodical, effective, somewhat under the radar way, which is a weird thing to say for a guy who's been winning so many races, but that is kind of how it feels to me. Whereas Moreira, just when he lights up, you think, oh, blimey, he's suddenly arrived on the scene. And it's a bit unfair that he gets treated differently, but that is, and off the bike, he kind of has that sort of X Factory look about him, and has a great social media presence. As we said, he's very sort of active on kind of motocross and stuff. He's top level there. Just everything about him is just, you've got something that teams can work with in terms of generating profile and interest, which is a big part of the sport. Like it or hate it, I mean, that is the reality of modern sport, whatever the discipline is. So, and I always think of kind of the Rossi thing, a year to learn, win in the class, go up, a year to learn, win in the class. That is what we're seeing with all the people we've just mentioned, Acosta, Moreira, David Alonso. So if you don't achieve that, I think you just your star dims too much, and then you just get overtaken by other people, kind of metaphorically and literally in many cases. So it's a shame, but that's the way the cookie crumbles.
Yep. So Miller is going to remain at Pramac for all the reasons you previously stated, Rich, and he will ride alongside World Superbike Champion Toprak. The question is, where does Oliveira go? So it looks like his best opportunity is to join Aprilia as a test rider,
Yeah, because his name is
unfortunately.
not coming up in any of the World Superbike kind of chatter that I've been reading or hearing about. So you would assume that his signature in test or reserve rider duty would probably be quite highly sought.
I think so.
Yeah.
He's a good setup guy.
But it's a tough position for him because he has a contract for next year, let's not forget.
Right.
But there we
Yep.
go.
Then
Contracts are written to be broken.
precisely. So Pol Espargaró, who subbed in for Vinales this weekend at KTM, he wants to return to full-time racing, and he wants to do it in World Superbike. I don't know if anybody's really got an interest in him for that position, but I admire the fact he wants to get back at it, considering that really devastating crash, right, that he had, that,
That plus
what, to
Acosta
be a,
coming up kind of was the end for him, wasn't it?
yeah.
Competitively, because again, he'd been around for a bit too long, really, and not achieving enough. But I'm kind of surprised that he wants to do that because he's carved out quite a successful commentary career with one of the European channels. I'm not sure which one it is, but so that I, and again, I you don't hear his name coming up in chatter around World Superbike, and there's, I mean, I don't know that I've written it in the notes, but just quickly to mention, there's some suggestion that come 2027, World Superbike might be minus BMW and Ducati,
Wow.
all of which kind of fits into a change of scenery for World Superbike and the new kind of regime. So yeah, it's going to be kind of interesting to see what happens in World Superbike over the next couple of seasons.
Other news, Yamaha will race the new V4 engine at San Marino this year. It'll be ridden by test rider Augusto Fernandez. That will be interesting to see here, slash, I really would like to be there just so that I could hear it, right?
Yeah,
But
although I'm sure it'll
anyway,
sound the same as all the other bikes next, because I mean, they're all
yeah.
V4s, aren't they? But
That is the problem. I remember, again, this is, let's call it the middle part of the 90s, late part of the 90s. I remember going to a race with some friends, and they had never been before. And we were walking in, and I think at the time Superbike practice was going on for what we now call Moto America. And I'm like, ooh, there's a Ducati that went by. Ooh, that's a Yamaha. Ooh, that's a Suzuki. Ooh, that's the Honda. They're like, how can you tell? It's like they all sound different. Now they sort of all sound the same. It's just kind of, yeah. Anyway, I mean, if they're all going to sound the same, then put a muffler on them.
I would need to look up, Jim, and I don't know if you know this, but I don't know if, as part of the modern rule set, and I guess 27 would stay the same, whether they eradicated the weight limit differences for slightly different configurations of bike, because of course that was what made MotoGP, when it first came up in 2002, so interesting, was that the triple you could run much lighter, relatively speaking, say, than a inline four or a V4, because we had triples, inline fours, V4s, and a V5 back then, if you recall. Might have missed an engine configuration out. I think Honda
No,
played
I think
around.
you got
They
it. I
played
think
around with
that's
a
every
six
one of
cylinder
them.
at some point, but anyway, that never raced. But and that made
Yeah.
for exactly that. You could, after you'd kind of got used to it, you could tell which bike was which pretty well.
Yeah. It's why I like endurance racing, because I can stand there and know that that's a Corvette, that's an Aston Martin, that's a Ferrari. They all
Yeah.
sound different. Porsche, whatever. Anyway, Sergio Garcia was back in Moto2 this weekend, and he will race in the class next year at Gresini alongside Alonso Lopez.
Yes, Alonso Lopez, not David
I had
Alonso.
to finish that thought.
Yeah.
Wait a minute, Alonso Lopez, not that
All change
Alonso.
at Gresini,
All
because
change at
obviously
Gresini.
Albert Arenas will be out, and who's the other rider at Gresini in Moto2? I'm trying to think now. It's escaping me. Anyway, it doesn't matter, but anyway, they're
Yeah,
both out
can't.
for next year, and yeah, so good
Was
to
it
see Garcia
Szalacs?
back.
No,
No, he's
it's
at
not
Mark
Szalacs.
VDS.
He's at Mark VDS.
So
Sorry.
I'm just having a stupid late night
Yeah.
mental blank at the moment, but it'll come to me in a moment.
It's my normal blank. Anyway, attendance figures for Hungary. I didn't see them announced by Dorna, but Rich has found that found this that they had 21,000 roughly Friday, 26,000 on Saturday. Sunday was 32,500, which gets us to like 80,000 for the weekend. That's as good as it gets at COTA. So I
Yeah,
don't know.
well, that's
So
quite a bit in ahead of where Silverstone was at this year.
yeah. It didn't look like it from the TV. I mean, obviously people can be in different places and stuff, but at no point did I think the grandstands were in the seating areas were full. But
Yeah.
hey, if you got 80,000, then call it a success and move on.
The local village fete had more people in attendance than Silverstone had, to be honest with you. So I'm sort of not holding Silverstone up as a marker of anything.
Ouch. So a bittersweet bit of news here, in my opinion. Johnny Rae retires at the end of 2025 from World Superbike. It's sort of like an end of an era, you know, like
Yeah.
Johnny Rae's stopped, you know, not riding. Then the question is whether Iker Lekuona would be confirmed at Aruba Ducati. As far as I know, that did not happen.
No, it has.
As
That's official now.
this is official now. Okay, so
This is all
I
official.
thought it did. Okay, that's official. Okay.
I think I had it on the notes last week when we recorded as a rumor. It has now been made official that that is where Lecuona will be, which is.
Good for
I mean,
him.
great for him. I'm personally pleased because I think he's a really, really good rider. But it's a slightly unexpected appointment, I have to say, but a great one for Lecuona, and may well see him if he can make it work. It may well see him get back to some MotoGP duty in the future, possibly,
Possible.
because that's the official Aruba IT team. That's not a satellite Ducati. That's He'll be in with Bulliger next year, so he's replacing Alvaro Bautista. Big
Interesting.
news.
That is big news. All right, let's talk about the race weekend at hand, which is starting off with Moto3 and
Oh,
qualifying.
Jim, sorry, can I just say
Yes.
the other bit of World Superbike news is that Bautista replaces Petrucci at Barney Spark Ducati, so they have made accommodations for Bautista, and that was the ride that, as far as I understand it, Johnny Rae was trying to get, but they couldn't agree on the terms. So, in the absence of that ride, and the fact that he would probably would have to fund a ride anywhere else in the World Superbike paddock outside of the other works bikes which are taken, hence, he's not going to stay put at Yamaha. So the retirement news came for that reason. But I think it's a good time because he's been falling off a bit recently and hurting himself. So it's better to stop and to look back on what is an amazing legacy and an amazing record in Superbike.
I
And
agree.
lament the fact that he never really quite got a good shot in MotoGP, which I think he was due, but again, I think he passed up some opportunities because because of the terms on offer. Anyway, there we go.
All right, let's get to Moto3. So,
Yeah.
opening and first qualifying, we learned that Yurate was going to go to the back of the grid, regardless of whatever he did in qualifying, because he was riding slowly online. Seems to be a theme with these people somewhere along the way. But you had Furusato. You had Kelso, you had Buchanan, Ogden, Nepa, and Moodley was there, and O'Gorman was there again, riding. The Irish kid was riding again, and there. As it boiled out or whatever, it came down to Kelso, Furusato, Yurate, and Scott Ogden all getting out of that first session. O'Gorman was fifth. He was so close; it was only a couple
A
hundredths of a
whisker,
second.
yeah.
Whiska, as they say, for him to be able to not go through. This kid deserves a Moto3 ride next year. Somebody needs to put him on one.
I think so, and it's worth just pointing out, Jim, as well. His teammate in the SICK 58 Squadra Corsa, is that the name of the team? Something like that. His
Something.
teammate Nepa was last. He's having a bit of a mare this year, Stefano Nepa. So O'Gorman's come into that team. I think this is his last ride out because I think Lynetta, who he's been subbing for in this last two rounds, who had a broken leg, if you remember back in Assen, was it? I
think
think
so, yeah.
should be back for the next round in Barcelona by the sounds of it. But like you say, Jim, O'Gorman has done easily enough to justify a decent ride on the grid full time next year, in my opinion.
I'm with you 100%. We got to that Q2 session, and everybody was trying to get a tow from Keelys because Keelys was the fastest guy like all weekend. He eventually just sort of rode into the pits just to get rid of the tow and said, "Well, I'm going to sit here for a while." Literally, it was halfway through qualifying, and Keelys had not put a time down. And I'm like thinking, dude, you need to go get a time. If somebody falls, get a yellow sector, anything, you're going to start not from the front row. You're going to be back on row eight or something. I guess you can't really go back that far to eight rows in the first, from the first, if you're in that second qualifying session. But he was going to be mired deep in the pack, right? If he didn't get
Yeah.
out there, because by halfway, it was Pironi, Carpe, and Panini, Piqueras, Rolston, and Fernandez were all there. And then finally, Keelys gets out and he sets a time and he got sixth, right? And then Keelys just goes to the top of the list. It wasn't like it was just by a little bit that he went fast. It was like he went fast by a lot, and as he had been the whole weekend. It eventually shook out with Keelys on the front row and in the pole position. Pironi would be second, then Piqueras, then Carpe, Munoz, Pini, Rolston, Rueda qualified eighth, then Adrian Fernandez, David Almanza, Foggia, and Ferrosato. It's a shame that Rueda qualifies eighth. I mean, I'm not sure. We come back to Austria. Rueda's sort of off the mark. I thought, okay, summer break, you got to put your mind back together again. Sometimes it takes a little bit to get that groove again. But it doesn't seem like, as of right this moment, that Rueda was back in the groove yet. He seems to not be the dominant person that was so dominant in the first half of the season, which is, I don't know. I don't want to say it's concerning, but then again, there are times when these guys who are would-be champions for the year have a little slump. I give you Pedro Acosta and his Moto3 season. Gangbusters, he came back from the summer break, right? Same thing, had a slump. Foggia got close, but Acosta still winds up winning the title. So
Yeah.
we'll see what happens.
It is concerning. I think it will be more concerning if it happens next time out in Barcelona, because there you
I
would
agree.
expect him to be super strong. If he's kind of mired down sort of in the lower echelons of the top 10 there, that is cause for concern. I highly doubt that will be the case. I think maybe he doesn't like Austrian Balaton part is you're going to get on with it or you're not. And he's in that odd position of having such a big lead that you're kind of scared to death that you're going to do something stupid and lose a big chunk of it all in one go. They always say it's easier to be the chaser than the hunted, so I'm putting it down to that at the moment.
We shall see what happens. When the at the start of the 20 laps for the Grand Prix on Sunday, Keelys got a hole shot, followed by Pironi and Piqueras, Carpe, Munoz, and Barreto got off an eighth there. Pironi did get by Keelys as the Keelys went wide in one of the next turns, but Keelys went right back by again, and Munoz was up to second shortly thereafter. So Keelys was definitely out front, definitely doing his thing that you would expect him to. And the front four guys had about a half a second gap about six laps into the race. Piqueras would move back to second. So it's like, well, okay, we're kind of going back and forth here. Then, Yamanaka and then Ogden crashed. And what really happened was that, like, Ogden went down and everybody else kind of avoided the situation. And then they kind of had little tip overs in the gravel and whatnot. I guess they're using the old Weir rule. If your handlebar touches the ground, you have crashed. So I guess you got to say that you crashed and remounted, however they want to look at it. That's their prerogative or whatever. With 10 laps in, Keelys is out front, Piqueras is in second, then it's Munoz, and then it's Pironi, Pini, and Rueda. So Rueda's sort of in the top six here. He's made a few places. Hey, you can't pass it hungry, right? So, whatever. I don't know. It seemed like he was doing okay with it. Keelys has a mistake at 15, and it dropped him all the way back to fourth place. At least Keelys did the right thing. He rode, he didn't try to back out of it and cut across the chicane. He just dealt with it, basically stopped, because it would have been hard to give back the second that was going to be required for anybody who did cut the chicane. So I think it was a smart riding move by Keelys to just, like, all right, I'm just going to figure out wherever I'm going to be. I'm just going to stop if I have to to not run through the chicane, and I'll just sort myself back out and we'll just go back at it again. And that is pretty much how that went down at that point. So Pironi's now leading, followed by Piqueras and Munoz, and Wakili slots back in fourth place, which really wasn't that big of a deal, right? So he's only fourth. Now, at this point, Munoz winds up getting like all kinds of out of shape, and Rueda winds up moving by. I mean, it's like you leave the braking late because you got to go to that last instant to be sure that you're quick, because you have to deal with the chicanes, and that's where you're going to lose time or make time is going to be on the brakes. So Munoz is trying, but wow, that thing was every which way but straight for a lot of it. And he did get by, did get around it, and was able to get on there. Now, it's about here that I remembered that Pironi was on a medium rear and everybody else is on a soft. Now, I'm thinking, is it really going to matter? Because we've seen, but then I thought back, well, we've seen Rueda run sort of the opposite strategy of what other people have ran on the rear tire, and it's paid dividends. So I'm like, this is going to be interesting to see how Pironi deals with this, because he's the only man on that tire. And it's either he's either genius or a fool, because it's usually that's how that works. But we were going to see as it came through. It was a group of five that was out the front, and Kelis, with 14 laps in, had got himself back to third. So he dealt with Munoz, which is not the easiest person in the world to pass, because he's going to fight right back. So it took Kelis a little bit to get there, and once he made it stick, he made it stick. And then okay, now he's third. So okay, well, let's see where Kelis goes here. With 15 laps in, it's Pironi, Munoz, Kelis. They've swapped it back again, or Munoz is back again in front of him. Then Piqueras, Rueda, and then there's like 2.2 seconds to get to Panini. Now Panini crashes out. Well, he's going to the long lap penalty lane for an incident for a track limits, I believe, was Pini's fault,
Yeah, I think
or
so.
his cause to go to the pit, go to there. With 5 laps to go, now Kelis is in second. Furuhata crashed at turn two. Then it's with four to go. It's Pironi and Kelis, Munoz, Piqueras, and Rueda. Okay, now the front two have got about 3 tenths, have got a little bit of a lead on Munoz, Piqueras, and Rueda. But with two to go, Pironi, has got a 3 tenths lead on Kelis. I'm like, that's kind of a lot, but thinking about it, that's not a lot considering you've got the hard braking zones. And if you miss it by a millimeter, Piqueras is going to be right back on, or not Piqueras, Kelis is going to be right back on you again. So, like, okay, what's going to happen here? Last lap, Kelis tried at one and he tried to make it stick, but he couldn't get it, right? Pironi stuck to his guns, held the line for turn two, and still led out of it. Okay, where's the next good place you're going to pass? What we've learned is turn five. So, all right, we're down a little bit of straightaway. Kelis demon breaks it, gets it there at five, and he's leading. He has now gotten to the lead. Pironi then tried at eight, no go. And then, he tried again at 14, but that didn't work. So, okay, I'm thinking Kelis has kind of got this. And he had a bit of a lead, because these sort of mistakes by Pironi, where he's trying to do something, and that enables, he has no drive onto the straightaway from 14 to 15. So Kelis has got a little bit of a lead, and Kelis does what anybody would do in that situation. Don't botch the corner that you're coming up to for the last couple of them. So Kelis actually breaks a little bit early, where Pironi says, screw it, I'm just going for it. And now it's a race, because they're both right there. They're trying to figure it out. They kind of go side by side. They wind up coming onto the front stretch, heading to the short run to the line. Pironi is on the outside of the track. He's on the outside. Kelis is to the inside. So Kelis, if you're looking down the front stretch, Kelis is on the right-hand side. Pironi's on the left. And Pironi moves over towards Kelis as they run to the line. Kelis puts an elbow out. They kind of bump. They separate. And Kelis wins the race. So Kelis wins that race. He in great fashion. I mean, again, Kelis is that kind of special that there is. With Pironi, who is now starting to find some incredible form right now, he's starting to look specialer, which I know is not a word, but it works in this case. Then Munoz was on the podium in third. Then Piqueras Rueda salvages a fifth, which is not that bad considering where he was when he started. He was eighth. He made three places. Then Almanza, Kelso, Carpe, Rolston rounds out the top 10. Then Foggia, Carraro, O'Gorman, who gets a point, right? This is his first points of this as in the Moto3 class because, you know, this is the Irish kid that we're talking about that we think has a lot of gumption. And then there's Yamanaka and Yurate finishes with the last point in 15th. I thought it was a great race, Rich, but some people think that the last move out of the final turn was a bit over the line. Do you think it is that move in the last turn and coming to the line was out of line for Moto3?
Personally, no. I think it's just typical Moto3. It came about because, yeah, as you said, Jim, people were just kind of going for it in those last couple of chicane corners. If you're going to design a track like this, this is the sort of thing that's going to happen, particularly in a class like Moto3. So for me, I mean, I took note of the fact that there was a bit of elbowing going on down the straights, but nobody kind of radically chopped across the front of anybody else. It was just a little bit of kind of like elbow to elbow stuff as people were kind of jockeying for position, or Pironi and Max Keelers anyway. So for me, no problem at all. Hard racing, and they were the class of the field. Those two, they swapped around a little bit as the race went on. It was a race of one lap, really, wasn't it? Which was the last lap. You know, they were in position. They'd ridden a good race, both of them. Munoz and the others has kind of dropped back a little bit at this stage, hadn't they? So they weren't really in the game at that point. So, not a terribly entertaining race as far as I'm concerned, but it kind of lit up on the last lap as Moto3 usually does. And as a track like this is obviously going to encourage to happen. Pironi's little gamble with the tyre didn't really sort of pay off, did it? But he came up against a guy that is clearly, for me anyway, is the class of the field this year. Yeah, Rueda's leading handsomely, but that's been a sort of a stealthy thing. A bit Gonzalez-ish again, I suppose, isn't it? A bit slightly unspectacular. Whereas Max is kind of like a win it or bin it kind of character, but he's starting to win it more than bin it, which, I mean, you'll talk about the points in a moment. He's quite far back, and I don't think he's got a sniff of the championship. But for me, he's the head turner at the moment, and I know there's recency bias, that's always a thing, so you can't ignore the fact that Rueda's still got a 69-point lead in the championship. But Quiles is the one that everybody's kind of talking about at the moment.
Yep, Keelys, remember, couldn't start at the beginning of the year. He had to wait several rounds because he wasn't old enough.
Exactly.
And it's like, so if you take away those rounds that Keelys is not there because he can't race, it is a very close championship then.
Yeah, because
But, you know,
Piqueras has under-delivered. I wouldn't say
oh yeah.
underperformed, but he's under-delivered.
For the hype that surrounded him and everything that was done to get him off of a Honda, to get him onto a KTM, and it's like,
Yeah,
okay,
I
what?
agree.
You need to show a little bit more than that. So my take on the last lap, I agree with you, Rich. I think it was just good hard racing. And then it was, you know, it was a journalist that we talk about a lot who posted it saying, you know, hey, there's a line and I think this is over. Now, that's fine. That's an opinion. You're allowed to it, right? I think it's good hard racing. The question that I should have asked back on Threads to this person was it Pironi that you're mad at, or was it Keelys you're mad at? Because Keelys had a reputation in World Junior that he put the chop on some people
Yeah.
quite extensively. Now, he got the sitting down, got the talking to of a lifetime that pretty much like, look, kid, you pull that crap one more time, you are not going to be in this series or riding a motorcycle at all. And if you tell that to people, yeah, you'll straighten yourself out. Now, Pironi was the one who, in my opinion, was moving towards Keelys. So if there's fault, and there isn't in my mind, right? It's good hard racing. If I'm Simon Crafar and somebody says, you have to penalize one of these guys for hard riding, I would penalize Pironi because he's moving towards Keelys, not Keelys moving towards Pironi. Yeah. So I
Yeah.
mean, it's hard to tell as well because the camera angle changes from what's happening in the corner to the long shot looking down the straightaway. So there's a bit of angle change that you don't see maybe all of what's going on, but I thought it was a good race. Again, it was a Moto3 race, so you had some passing, you had some argy bargy there, here and there, a rather subdued kind of race, I would think, but that eventually last lap magic appeared and voila, you wind up talking about, you know, this great last lap because it really was a pretty fantastic last lap in the lexicon of, you know, Moto3 races. So
Yeah, and I mean, I might be wrong on this, Jim, because I don't know that I hang around for the Parc Fermé stuff because I've kind of watched the race on catch up. I don't think there was an inquiry in terms
There
of,
wasn't,
I don't
no.
think the stewards looked at it. So for me, I don't really get what the big hoo-ha is. I think, and although I share, as we'll come to towards the end, I share some concerns about the track. I think people were a bit heightened. Certain people were a bit heightened this weekend, with good reason, because
Good,
they're
yeah.
concerned about safety and riding standards and so on. But like you, for me, no harm, no foul there.
I totally agree. As we look to the Riders' Championship, it's Rueda's to lose because he's on 250 points. He's 69 ahead of Piqueras. Piqueras really needed a win here if he was going to try to make any attempt at getting to Rueda. I'm beginning to lean towards it's not if Rueda wins, it's when does Rueda win. He's got to keep that top five finishing going on and whatnot. But Kelis has moved into third, and considering, like we talked about, he hasn't raced all the rounds.
Yeah.
And I think then he broke his finger or something, and so he couldn't run like another couple of rounds, I think,
Well, I think
if
that's
I'm
right.
remember
Yeah.
correctly. So he's in third on 164 points, and he puts him 86 back of Rueda. But then after that, it's Munoz. So he actually vaults over Munoz, and like he's got a 9-point lead on Munoz. And then Carpe, Kelso, Pironi, Yamanaka, Fernandez, and Almanza finish out your top 10 in Moto3.
I think Barcelona will give us a better kind of gauge, Jim, as to where the rest of the season's going to go, because Red Bull Ring straight after the summer break, it's a bit of an odd track again. It's kind of straight break.
Same
Balaton
thing
Park,
here.
new track and the same sort of thing again, and so easy to kind of make a mistake. I mean, the key thing about Rueda is he salvaged the fifth again, as he did in Austria. So that's championship winning form when you're not having the best of weekends. Everybody's going to turn up at Barcelona. It's the track everybody knows, especially the Spaniards that have been running racing there since they climbed out of the cot. So it will be pretty easy to see where the competitive order lies again, I think, once we get there.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you. So let's move to Moto2.
Yes.
All right. So with qualifying here, when the first one, there's some big names in this first qualifying session. It's kind of shocking. Arenas, Arbolino, then Van de Gerberg, Navarro, Roberts, Canet. There's your big one, right? Vietti, and then Baltus, right? Those guys are all there, which you kind of don't really expect those guys to be there. But by halfway, things were looking poor for Canet. He couldn't really string a lap together. The bike seemed to be really unstable under braking, especially from the shots that I saw. And he wasn't even in the top four to get out. But Canet did jump to first. Roberts moved to fourth. Baltus then moved to first. So it was Zonta van de Gerberg who actually got to first, and then Baltus, then Canet and Roberts. That's how they actually got out. So those guys all got out of that session. The second qualifying session was only interesting in the fact that they were talking about emphasizing, I think, I don't know if they said this in Austria, Rich, maybe they did, but I know they said it here in qualifying, was that David Alonso's problem in qualifying is the fact that he can't get the best out of a brand new tire. I think they said it in Austria. They emphasized it again here. They said, but man, you put 10 to 15 laps on the tires and it's like suddenly turns into magic. Like he just, is going for it at that point. And, he's been talking about how he has to work at getting better at his qualifying and getting the most out of that rear tire. So I thought, okay, well, he's made it to the first qualifying session automatically. So maybe perhaps he's got something fixed. He's found a setup. They've got done something, air pressures, who knows, right? All those things are crucial when you're trying to get your tire temperatures up and get it to where it needs to be. But you had Moreira, Gonzalez, Szalacs, Baltus, Canet, and Zonta Gerberg, who were going there. And then when you got to the end, there's a lot of guys that were going quick. I mean, there was people up and down the list that had red times, red sectors. So you really didn't know how this was going to pan out. But it shook out to be Moreira with pole, Van de Gerberg, who would be second. Then Gonzalez had jumped into third. Dixon had a good rescue to be fourth. Then Vire, who had been quick most of the weekend, didn't seem to be able to put it together, but you kind of got the impression that Vire was starting to figure it out. We're,
Yeah.
halfway through, right? Then Canet, who showed form because, of course, Canet seems to be able to suck it up and put a lap in and get there. So he was going to start in the first two rows. Then it was Helgado, Alonso, eighth, right? Then Sasaki, Szalacs, Ramirez, and Huertas was 12th, right? So there's your first four rows. We go into the race on Sunday, and it was, there was no tire drama that was going to show here. Everybody was on the same set of tires, right? So there was no difference in here. It was Gonzalez who got a whole shot, followed by Marrera, and then it was you thought, okay, those guys are going to get out front, they're going to lead, they're going to go away. But Dixon pulled off a great move. So as Gonzalez and Marrera both went deep into turn one, that put them wide. Jake seemed to have sort of checked up a little bit, dove to the inside, took a very tight line, accelerated, squirted out, and was able to get by both of Gonzalez and Marrera to lead as they exited out of turn two, which was like, oh, okay, this is kind of different. Didn't see this coming. Meanwhile, Vietti, Cooney, Orade, and Bender all crashed in the first turn back in the back behind it. I watched the replay back and forth several times. I couldn't figure out who caused the crash
It
or
was a
what really
melee.
happened. It was a melee, and even race control couldn't figure out what was going on because they were like, yeah, no further action. Because even they didn't know who did what, when, or where.
That
So,
turn one, turn two,
oh,
that track
terrible.
is just, we saw it in World Superbikes. Andrea Iannone wiped out several people, including Nicolò Caruana, who broke his wrist as a result of that. Yeah, it's just going to happen. I was amazed, frankly, that it didn't happen in Moto3. They all got through cleanly, which was like a big, big surprise. But yeah, unfortunately, Moto2. And Darren Binder, he's the other guy on the Gresini this year. And the reason we couldn't remember him, of course, is we never see him in a race because he's either at the back or crashed. So another guy that won't be in Moto2 next year.
Correct. So Dixon is leading, followed by Marrera, then Gonzalez, Huertas, Canet, who survived that first turn, and Vire. So, okay, cool. This is all good. Guevara would get a jump start. He was a little too good. His reaction was a little too good. So he got the double long lap penalty on there. Marrera worked by lap four. Marrera had worked himself into the lead. He was past Dixon, and it was then Gonzalez, Canet, Vire, and Huertas. Alonso was in seventh at this point, and Marrera had like 0.3 on Dixon and Gonzalez, and it was 1.1 to Canet. So Alonso is like 2.5 seconds or more behind everybody. And it's like, yeesh. I mean, kid, you really are gonna. I'm thinking, you really have got to sort qualifying, because if you're on the first row, second row, you'd probably be leading this thing right now, but he can't qualify. So I'm like, well,
You're kind of thinking at this stage he might get a third.
or a fourth, maybe. I thought fourth, because I mean, the way they were talking about his race, his times, it was like, well, the gap was so big that he could maybe only get to fourth. And I'm like, I kind of dismissed Alonso at this point. I mean, I like to look where Alonso is because I want to see the learning curve he's on. But it was like, man, I don't know what's going on with this by this point or whatever. But Gonzalez would work his way past Dixon. He really needed that pass, right? Dixon was the roadblock because Marrera was leaving the situation. He was checking out and he was going to go for it. And, good on Gonzalez to get the move, get it done. And then, hey, go chase down Marrera, which is what Gonzalez actually did. Alonso, so I should say, with 10 laps in, it's Marrera, Gonzalez, Dixon, Canet, Vire, and Huertas. But by 12 laps in, Alonso has gotten by Huertas, and he's chasing down Canet and Vire. Like, okay, this might be something. Man, that's a sniff of maybe a little bit better than fourth. Maybe a podium might be in play here. That's where I've got, podium here, right? But Lopez then was down in a big crash. There was lots of barrel rolls, man. And then his own self barrel rolled into the air fence and bounced off of it. I'm amazed at the technologies of safety that we have now compared to just, roughly the 20 odd years ago that I was racing bikes. Airbags and suits, air fence everywhere. I mean, that was a pretty good hard wallop, and he got up and got there. But as I've said many a times before, some of the tracks we go to are not safe because the walls are too close to the circuit for the speed that the bikes are traveling at. This is a Moto2 bike, and it made it all the way to the fence without a problem. And its rider made it all the way to the fence without a problem, too.
Yeah, one other observation of that crash with Lopez in particular, Jim, is that I know we're going to talk about the track briefly at the end, but so we'll kind of have the discussion about whether there should be more runoff. But what they've done to compensate for the lack of runoff is make the gravel quite deep. And what you tended to see was bikes digging in and going high up into the air. And Alonso, from the angle I looked at that from on TV, was rather lucky not to get hit by the bike coming down because it landed quite close to him. And luckily, we don't see those sorts of crashes all that often. But I think it was, and obviously, we'll talk about Pedro Acosta's crash in a little while.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm
Yep,
laughing. I
yep.
shouldn't be laughing. Same thing again, where the gravel was deep in order to try and slow stuff down as much as possible, but it does always risk this kind of catapult effect of stuff going skyward. So Lopez was lucky to get away with that one because it was a pretty big crash.
It was a big crash. He wasn't hurt, which is the best news that you could possibly have, either
Yeah.
bikes are replaceable, human beings are not. Vire had got by Kinect. And then Alonso got by as well. With 15 laps in, Smerer, Gonzalez, Dixon, Vire, Alonso, Kinect. So, there's fifth. If Alonso gets Vire, he's fourth, which matches what Matt Bird and everybody were talking about in the commentary. Like, hey, we should be good there. But we found out that Gonzalez got by Moreira at turn five. So now Gonzalez is now back out in front again. But on 17 laps then, Alonso got by Vire, and I'm like, that's it. We're done. This is as good as he's going to get. Because you have to admit that both Gonzalez and Moreira had a pretty decent gap on Alonso at this point in time. And I thought, well, a podium is good. The kid is learning, he's getting better or whatnot. But the problem was that Moreira was not about to give up on Gonzalez. So if those two started fighting, well, then we can see some lap times get slower, and if you're on a clear track, you're usually faster than the people who are fighting. And well, guess what? Alonso was moving on. So now Alonso had to get by Dixon, and basically he made that move like right now. Like there was no way around it. It was a quick, hard slash pass, boom, done. Got you. I'm out of here. And I'm like, whoa, with that kind of pace, and if the guys out front kind of get together a little bit. Alonso's in with a shout here. He's definitely got a podium, right? But he's in with a shout.
You're thinking Alonso Moto 3 kind of
Right. You
behavior here,
have
aren't
this
you?
flashback, right?
End
Yeah,
of
you
the
have this.
race, here he comes.
Yep. And it's like, oh, it's like, what the heck's gonna happen here? Because we've seen this. I've seen this story unfold before, just not in this class. But we got down to three laps, and it was Gonzalez, Moreira, and Alonso. But then with two laps to go, Alonso gets by Moreira at turn one. The rear was off the ground. The bike's snaking every which way. The front starts to tuck as the back hits the back, as the back sets back down onto the racetrack. That puts weight onto the front end because of the grip. It pushes the front. Alonso just, I got it. Picks it up, got it, squirts it out, done. And probably one of the best Moto2 passes I've seen in a long time. Just
Yeah.
from the standpoint of that kid was out of control, out of shape. And in no way should he have been able to save that. But all the people that we love to watch who can save things that nobody else can, he's sort of in that alien group of being able to do things that you shouldn't be able to do on a motorcycle, but he did.
What I like to call one of my famous oxymorons a control crash.
Yes. It looked like a controlled crash, to be honest with you. I mean, I don't know how he saved it. There was one to go, and Alonso tries to get by Gonzalez at one. And it was like, oh, that can't be. It's like it doesn't really work. But eventually Alonso gets by Gonzalez. Moreira would go by him as well and would push, Gonzalez out so he could get there. But then Alonso like blows the last chicane. I'm like, oh no, you can't do this. Don't lose it now after putting in all this hard work to come from, I don't want to say deep in the pack, but let's say a significant distance back on a track that's hard to pass on. You do all this great work, but Moreira could not get him. And Alonso wins his first Moto2 race, which he kind of Moto3'd the Moto2 guys, if you follow that sentiment,
Yep.
which it was a fabulous win. There's no way around it. It was an absolutely fabulous win for Alonso. I mean, that's one. Hands down, the best race of the day, easily, I think. I
Yes.
think we'll agree with that. Moreira was on the podium, followed by in second, and then followed by Gonzalez, who takes the last spot. Dixon was fourth, Vire fifth, which was a great ride for Vire because, I think the kid is starting to figure that one out, right? He just so happens there happens to be this other kid that's really good. maybe even a little better than you, who's figured it out just that little bit faster. And then you've got Kinect in sixth, so that was a recovery for him to be able to essentially gain some points a little bit on Gonzalez. Then Huertas was seventh in Slatch, Holgado, Ortola, Ramirez, Baltus, Van de Gerberg, Albert Rance, and Tony Arbolino got the last point. Can't say enough good about Alonso on this one, Rich. How about you?
Well, yeah, I mean, we kind of surmised early in the season or at the beginning of the season that it would take him a little while to adjust. And of course, let's not forget he had a broken collarbone just before the first round as well. So that obviously knocked his sort of final preparations before the season got going in Thailand, I think it was, wasn't it? So we always kind of say that sometimes a Moto3, a good Moto3 rider, or in Alonso's case, a Moto3 champion, will kind of make the transition reasonably quickly, by which we mean to say within half a season normally. And again, talking about Pedro Acosta, of course, this is what he did. He just unfortunately broke his leg in a training accident halfway through the season, so couldn't kind of make good and then ran rampant the following season. And I suspect that this is probably what we're going to see with David Alonso. I think I WhatsApped you, didn't I, Jim, to say,
Yeah.
here we are. This is where we thought we would get to. It was just a question of when, not if. Look at the Moto2 champion of 2026, and he'll be hopping onto a new generation MotoGP bike in 2027. I mean, there's a lot of water to go under the bridge before that all happens, of course, but that is something you can easily envisage happening. So, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, obviously, he was challenging for the podium and was going for the win in Austria. Okay, he made a mistake. He sort of threw it up the road, so didn't finish that race. But he was already showing that late race pace again. And well, it wasn't necessarily the feature of him in Moto3, because obviously he'd been riding a Moto3 bike for many, many years. So there he kind of hung around at the front, and then just sort of did the business in the last few laps. Whereas at the moment, I made a note, and I don't know. This is probably just me talking absolute rubbish, but I would love to see him in the flesh, because obviously I interviewed him last year at Silverstone, and you were literally looking at a kid that looked like he'd just started at primary school in terms of his stature. And I remember making a comment to you, he was obviously going to need to bulk up for the Moto2 bike, and I wonder if his continued struggles at the moment, and it would be fascinating to see where he's at physically in terms of his muscle mass and stuff. I wonder if he's still not quite there yet, which is why he's struggling to really kind of manhandle a bike on sticky sort of fresh tires in qualifying. Whereas by the time he gets sort of late race, once the fuel load's dropped off a little bit, he's much, much better on lower grip at that later stage of the race. Because that, I mean, he was like way faster than everybody else in the last 10 laps, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah.
So I just wonder if that's kind of where he's at the moment. I mean, I don't know, he's probably not going to grow much taller, so he's quite a sort of short, stocky kid, but then most of the riders are, frankly. But I can't remember how old he is now. He's 18, maybe 18, 19, I'm guessing.
19.
Yeah. So he'll still sort of change physically in terms of muscle mass and all the rest of it and strength. So yeah, would be interesting to sort of see where he's at on that journey, really. But I think we've seen the star sort of arrive. So again, as I always kind of repeat myself, fascinating to watch the next few races, because he's the kid that with that kind of form could go on a bit of a rip now.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that it could be physicality. That's why he can't get a hold of the tire or whatever. But perhaps maybe this kid just has incredible feel for the tire when it's also worn. So that's the flip side of the coin, right?
Yeah, that sort of otherworldly sort of ability to read the grip before it's there sort of thing.
Yeah,
Although he did
totally.
screw up the last corner, but maybe it's just a rush of blood to the head.
I have to admit, the first time I won a dirt track, I kind of screwed up the last corner too, because you're thinking you're going to do something you've wanted to do, and you get a little excited, I guess. But anyway, I will forgive him.
And by the same token, they say once you've kind of got the monkey off your back, maybe starts to come a bit easier.
Yeah.
I mean, it won't be easy in Moto 2 because he's still up against the same people. But yeah, he would have caught a few people's attention with that ride.
Anyhow, I think Alonso has come along at a great time as far as his age, maturity, and where he is, because he's going to jump onto a 27 MotoGP bike when it's all change. It doesn't matter who you are, everybody's going to learn that bike,
Yeah.
and he could really surprise us in 27. However, we have a while to get to there, and before that, we have to decide who's going to be world champion in Moto2. And as of right now, Gonzalez is still world champion, elect at 204 points, but Kinnett has now cut that gap to one race victory, which is 25 points. More importantly, is Moreira has now cut the gap to 31 points to Gonzalez, which is a race victory and a smidge more. Any mistake, any problem by Gonzalez at this point, and Moreira wins, ooh, that's a 6-point difference.
Yeah,
Okay.
long way to go yet as well.
Long way to go. This one's going to the wire. This is the one championship that will go to the wire. Is going to be this one. After that, it's Baltus, who's now 57 points behind. So that's, I don't see that anything good happening there. Dixon's fallen to 72 points behind. Then it's Vietti Onchu, who is not racing and won't race for a couple weekends yet. And then Arenas, Senna Agius, and Marcos Ramirez running out the top 10. That's everything I got for Moto2, Rich. For MotoGP time.
Yeah, I think
Okay.
it's MotoGP
Or nap time. Take your pick, right?
Yeah.
Either one. Interestingly, in the first qualifying session for MotoGP, you had Martin, Bezzecchi, Didier, Bagnaia, Miller, and Zarco. So the two factory Hondas actually were in the second session, and one Fabio Quartararo on a Yamaha was in that first session. So, that's kind of it. It was obvious in that qualifying session that Bagnaia was lost. He literally had no clue. None. Zero. At all, what to do about that bike and what it was doing. It was like he came in and he did the thing where it's pumping in the middle of a corner. He just, I don't, whatever they were trying, because I think they tried a radical setup, if you will, to try to get something to work for him, didn't even come close to doing anything for him, which was a bit terrifying. Bez was flying, that was for sure, right? He's a former race winner or whatever. So Bez and Binder were out front or were going to go through. Halfway through, then Bagnaia did jump up to second. I admit to that he did kind of put a tire on, kind of sucked it up. I think he went for it. Miller then bumped out Bagnaia, then Binder jumped into second. Then Bez just moved the goalpost by throwing down a lap that like nobody was going to even remotely touch. Didier did try. He actually tied. Sorry, tied, as in he turned the exact same lap time as Binder. But Digia gets to go through because on the count back, Digia had a second lap. His second fastest lap was faster than Binder's second fastest lap. So Digia gets to go into qualifying too, which is kind of a bad break for Binder because he's sort of been lost here lately, as most of the KTMs have been, which I, Binder's a good rider, not a great rider, but Acosta is the man who's in charge there, and what Acosta wants, Acosta gets. So we shall see.
Yeah, I
I
mean,
don't know.
Binder must be said had a good race in Austria.
He
They've
did.
found something, or they've been developing something which he has started to be able to, with his own changes in riding style and so on, has been able to start to kind of take advantage of. And so we saw a continuation of that. And I mean, he missed out by the tiniest of margins in terms of getting through Q2. I'm
Yep.
just curious on your take on Bagnaia, though, Jim. I mean, it's kind of like watching the Five Stages of Grief, isn't it, with him? He's sort of gone through the angry stage and the sort of the disbelief bit, and it well, I don't know, it just kind of seems like a it's that sort of 40-yard stare now, isn't it? It's just complete. He's not even angry anymore. I mean, interestingly, he made some pretty punchy comments towards Ducati at the end of the Austrian weekend, and he apologized for that in the Thursday press conference. I think he kind of rolled back on that rhetoric a little bit and said that he regretted it. Which I think was very magnanimous of him to do that, because how can you say that when the other bike's winning at will, you know? So at this point, he just—it's a bit painful to watch, actually. I mean, he just doesn't know what to do next, it seems. Whatever they try, it's just nothing's kind of working. And it's—well, I mean, I don't know what you think, but
Yeah,
I think
nothing's
we now expect
working.
him to go out, don't we?
Yeah, I mean they're trying, but they can't figure it out. And I have noticed, and I don't know if this is truly a cause or reason, but do you ever see on the TNT coverage, do you ever see Gigi Dallina anywhere near Bagnaia's motorcycle ever?
Rarely.
I mean it's rare. Okay, if
Yeah.
it's there, it's rare. From the Dorna feed, like the last 2 weekends, Gigi Dallina is nowhere near Bagnaia's motorcycle. If they're out on the grid, that where's Gigi? He is by Mark's bike.
Yeah.
Now, I don't, I do not believe in my heart of hearts that Gigi Dallina is not trying to help Benyaya with that motorcycle. But I believe that actions speak louder than words at times, and it is plain as the nose is on your face that Benyaya is not the favorite son at Ducati anymore.
Yeah, and I would support what you've just said by remembering how often Tardozzi and Delinia were down in the Gresini pit when Mark got a second or a third last season. Have you ever seen them down here this year when Alex
Nope.
Marquez has been getting one?
Nope.
So it's
But
clear
DG's.
what the direction of travel's been for quite some time
Yep.
now.
Mark had that 23 bike, and, basically GG was down there, notebook in hand on one knee, listening to Mark talk about what that bike did. And quite honestly, in most of those pictures from that year, DG is captivated, captivated by what Mark says.
Hanging on every word, yeah.
He is, yes. He is absolutely captivated by what Mark Marquez is saying. I don't know. Is Mark's feedback that much better than Benyaya's? I don't know. I have no clue. I'll never be able to tell you.
Well, and this is the point that I raised earlier on about, is this a danger point for Ducati?
Yep, I
Do
think it
they
is.
get sort of lulled into a false sense of security? Because the warning signs are there. Okay, DiGiantonio had a much better weekend, but that's off the back of several pretty poor weekends, it must be said, on the 25 bike. So it's not as if Bagnaia is alone in terms of struggling on the 25, and it is a shame that there's only three of them out there, not four or five, but anyway, that's just the way it is. So they got one guy that can make it work, who's a goat, possibly the goat.
Possibly.
Again, that's a, we'll park that one for another day.
Well,
And do they find themselves in the HRC conundrum, which is that it's fine whilst he's there, but what are you left with once he's not?
I think it's in any motorsport where you have a teammate and you are theoretically in identical equipment, whether it's cars, bikes, whatever, doesn't matter. Formula cars, I don't care. If the second car, bike, slash whatever isn't anywhere near the front or in the top five, and there's one guy who is consistently winning, and the other one is 10th, 12th, 15th all the time, you have a problem with your motorcycle or your car,
Yeah.
and you better fix it, and you better fix it quick, because that means the one person that's doing whatever is special, and it's not going to get any better. It's only going to get worse, because, and it may accelerate itself somewhat here, because
All right, everybody, we're back. We just had a 10-minute break as Jim had a major power outage at home, so we've lost track slightly of where we were. But Jim, we were talking about Bagnaia being a bit of a lost sheep at the moment, trying all sorts of stuff with the bike, not seemingly able to find a direction, retreating to a position of not blaming Ducati quite so much, but nevertheless looking like a man that's going to have a pretty tough, what, coming 4 months until this horror show is over. And then the next horror show that he faces is the argument internally at Ducati about whether they run a more 24 bike than a 25 bike next year, which a certain Marc Marquez, if he's true to form, might have something to say about.
yeah, I'm pretty sure we covered a bit of it till the power went out about Gigi and who he's by, and how he hangs on Mark's,
Yeah.
every word and whatnot. But yeah, I mean, Benyaya is lost, that's for sure. I think they're still working at it. I mean, it was said later on that he, after the race on Sunday, which we haven't gotten to yet, but he did say that he finally felt like he could ride the bike like himself, and he seemed really upbeat and really positive about what they found. Now, who knows what it is, but if they found it, great. If they haven't, this is going to be even worse, right? For Benyaya, because the rest of the season is going to be terrible. But I mean, it's already a lost season. But I mean, we're hopeful that Benyaya can be, next year, be on a Ducati and be equal to Mark, or at least give him some kind of a challenge in here. And I mean, if Martin can have a good Aprilia, then hey, things are going to be better. But yeah, at the moment, yeah, it's really tough to be Pecco Bagnaia. It's tough to watch Pecco Bagnaia. You can't help but feel sorry for him. I think we're talking about the stages of denial or whatever, and
Yeah.
he's just given up or whatever. I was thinking it's more like Dante's seven layers of hell, and he's now like
Yeah.
he's now reached like layer five or something, which is, I don't know what level five is in Dante's layers of hell, but he's there at five, where I think you're almost close to the acceptance that, this is it. I'm refined to doing something that I don't want to do for eternity.
And who's the
But
little
yeah,
red
it's
devil
terrible.
stood on the top, waving
Yes.
him down?
Something like that, for sure, anyway.
I just got to say, Jim, I don't give any credence to some of this speculation about the fact that Bagnaia is out of Ducati next year.
No way.
Not a
No.
chance that's happening. But Fermin Aldeguer will be turning some heads in terms of what happens in the immediate aftermath of, say, Bagnaia and/or Marquez not being there anymore. That's for
24
sure.
bike.
Yeah.
It's a 24 bike. So
Exactly.
we have to keep that in mind, you know?
Yeah, because the other thing we were talking about was whether the Ducati are at risk of going up a, you know, a bit of a Marc Marquez blind alley.
They are. It's this again has that familiar tune, right? Lorenzo can't ride a Honda. Mark is winning races on like there's no tomorrow. And then a year or so later, Mark breaks his arm trying to ride a bike that's unrideable. You've got to believe that that Ducati may do that, right? But I think it's more that one's more Honda's culture than it is anything else, right? Honda, I don't think Honda ever wants to admit openly that their motorcycles were good because they had some of the greats riding them. I give you Spencer, Doohan, Gardner, throw Marquez into this, right? Because there was a
Rossi.
long stretch. Rossi, yes, sorry, forgot. But yeah, Rossi, but there was a long stretch when they went to 800s that Honda wasn't winning.
They got it wrong. Yeah.
They got it wrong because Honda, I mean, again, first things first, I don't know of any Honda motorcycle in Grand Prix racing over the decades that's actually handled. The new one they have right now might be the best handling one they've ever had, which is wild to think that, right? But on the flip side, it doesn't have any horsepower either. So the chassis
Yeah.
may be sucking once you get enough horsepower into it, right? So there's always that risk that that's going to happen. But I think that risk is way more cultural for Honda to inherently do that because Ducati literally could have taken this year off and not built a different bike at all. They could have just tinkered with the 24, but they didn't. They built a better, what they thought was a better bike. And it's not, they're lucky to have Marquez. Honda would look at it and have a great season. They're like, no, this bike is completely trash. Let's just go pray at the altar of speed again and just make something with so much horsepower that, no one can ride it. It's good to have horsepower, right? But if the rider can't effectively use that horsepower, it's pointless.
All that being said, Jim, and I can't remember the guy's name, but Honda HRC have poached KTM's top engine guru guy.
Oh,
I'm not
really?
quite sure when he goes over, because I would imagine he'll be on some sort of gardening leave, but he will produce
That's stupid.
the missing horsepower.
I'm going to rant here for a second. I
Sure.
don't understand the idea of gardening leave. Do you seriously think that if you say, if I'm going to leave my work and go to a competitor, that in a year off or whatever, I'm going to forget everything I know about what you did, how we did it, what we did? It's ridiculous. I just don't get it.
It's more to stop the transition of that knowledge happening any sooner than it absolutely has to, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I know, but I mean, I just
But yes, it's very petty.
it's petty. Whatever, we're done.
Yeah.
I'm over that. Let's move
Anyway,
on.
sorry, we
Where
must
were
crack on,
we?
but we were just getting to the end of Q1 there.
Oh, yeah, we were at the end of Q1. Yes,
God's sake,
so
that's as far as we got.
yes, as far as we got, because then we kind of sidetracked things
So did
with
you got
Pecco.
second? Because he
Yep.
just shaded Binder out, didn't he?
Yeah, so we go into the second qualifying session, and then Acosta goes down at turn eight. Now that front end was just a bouncing. That wasn't chatter. That was bouncing. There's a
Yeah.
difference. Chatter tends to stay on the pavement. This one was not on the pavement. Acosta did everything he could to save it. He eventually winds up just letting go and tosses it away. As you correctly said earlier, the gravel is deep to slow in an effort to slow the bikes down. However, that makes for very easy for handlebars, foot pegs, and things to dig in. And Acosta's bike gets to tumbling, gets to rolling. And what does it do? It bounces up and smacks the camera that's there in turn eight. And Acosta's got the great view of this, right? Because he's sliding in on his back. He can see everything that's going on. You can watch Acosta look, and you can almost see his eyes go big behind the tinted visor at, oh, bleep, because this is going to be bad because I may have potentially be going to kill a cameraman at this moment, right? Thank the lucky stars that the bike just kind of, I'll call it grazed the actual camera and then fell to the ground in a piled heap of absolute trash. I don't think you could salvage anything out of that motorcycle because it was trashed from that. Luckily, Acosta then jumps to his feet, looks to the camera guy who signals, "Hey, yeah, I'm okay," after having left his post, which then Acosta then grabs a scooter from some journalist, photographer, whatever, and hauls butt back to the pits, you know? So you can laugh about it now because it wasn't serious, right? It was close.
Well,
And
it
the
was.
reactions of the people, yeah, the reactions of the people involved make it funny, right? Because of what's going on. Now, to the team's credit, to Acosta's credit, they invited the camera guy down. Acosta met him. They talked for a bit. "Are you okay?" "Yeah." "Did you get, did you break the camera?" "Well, I broke my bike." "Ha ha," which was kind of a funny moment in the pits. He's like, "Hey, do you want to come see the box?" So Acosta takes him in, tours him around. He signs a knee puck for him, a slider, knee slider. And, he's like, "Hey, I'll stop by after the race and say hi." He's like, "Well, anytime." And he does. And Acosta does at the end of the race on Sunday. And I think it was great of Acosta to do that way. I mean, Acosta is a real person too, and I think sometimes we tend to put the good racers on a pedestal and all that, but they are good people. And that was Acosta being a good person and doing what was right by him. That I don't think that was the team saying, "Well, really, we need to go over here and do blah blah blah." That was Acosta going like, "Hey, where's the camera guy? Can I see him? I want to be sure he's okay." This is, I don't think you ever find any more truer people than motorcycle racers. I've known some car racers that are a real pain in the you know what, but Acosta's not that way, right? So Acosta gets back or whatever, right? He gets back, he gets a spare or whatever. Marquez is on, at this time is on pole, then Bastianini, then Mir, right? Which is, whoa, that there's a Honda that close, which obviously the Hondas were probably going to be good because they handle. Although Zarco couldn't figure it out, but Mir seemed to have it figured out. And again, you rate Mir, and I'm hot and cold as to whether Mir, is that great. And so I'm not sure where to put that. But it does appear that he was had something going right at this point in time. But when it came down to it at the end, Digia kind of bounced up to third. Acosta bounced up to fifth, but he also got balked by yellow flags when he had a good run going. But Marquez would take pole, Bez would be second, Digia gets third, then Bastianini, and then Morbidelli, Quartararo, and Acosta. So Acosta would wind up at least starting sixth, which put him in a good place. But Acosta was really the only person from practice who had a chance at being near Marquez. So I think Marquez could pull something special out and have a one lap flyer. Acosta, we haven't seen that really from him in a MotoGP bike, but I wouldn't put it past the kid because if you look back to Austria, he was like 3/10 faster through the first three sectors and, probably should have been on pole in Austria, but did have that big front end tuck in 10, and that kept him from being on pole. So could Acosta have been on pole? Well, if ifs and buts were candy and nuts, we'd all have a very Merry Christmas, right? But that's called racing, and that's why you line up for the
I would
sprint.
throw Marco Bezzecchi into the mix on that as well, Jim, because he, I think what we're seeing with Bez is that he builds through Friday and Saturday.
Agreed.
What we haven't obviously seen yet, again, going back to Martin and at risk of repeating myself slightly, but Martin is the qualifier extraordinaire, let's not forget. So maybe he will start to trouble or at least push Marquez into having to stretch his limits a little bit further. But I agree, Acosta is explosive over a lap, and that KTM is certainly getting much better.
Yep, very
It's
much
worth
so.
pointing out as we come to the discussion about the track in a minute. So Marquez's pole lap was 136.518. I think that was his pole time or the
I don't
fast
remember.
top rat Rascatiogu's well superbike pole, sorry, I just murdered his surname then. It's late. But his pole time a couple of months ago, or whatever, 6 weeks ago, whatever it was a 138.397. So yeah, about well, not quite 2 seconds slower a lap, but fairly significantly slower a
Wow.
lot across what is quite a short lap.
Yeah. And a tight lap. Wow. So if we look at how qualifying finishes out, we had our first three, right? Then Bastianini, Morbidelli, and Quartararo take up the second row. Then Acosta, Audiger, and Marini take the third row, followed by Mir, Alex Marquez, and Pol Espargaró finishing on that fourth row. So we go to the sprint, right? Marquez just gets a great start on this one, right? Quartararo then goes whipping up the inside and What was that line Casey Stoner asked Rossi? What happened? Did your ambition outweigh your talent,
Yes,
or
that was
something?
it.
Something to that effect. Basically, that happens to Quartararo, where he took his brain out and set it on the shelf with the helm with his baseball cap before he got on the bike, right? And he goes up the inside and winds up smashing into Bastianini, and somehow Bastianini stays upright, but the bike's aero on the back is completely trashed and whatnot. Now, Quartararo did get a long lap penalty for the race on Sunday, which was fair, right? I mean, he really did talk that up, let's be honest.
Yeah.
But if we go back to the racing or whatever, it's really, it's what you expect. There's really nothing happening other than Marquez is out front. There is a pretty good battle that's happening behind them and whatnot, right? But nothing much else happens. Aldeguer does get by Mir along the way, right? Because Mir ran wide. Acosta would fall at turn 11. He was threw another one away in the gravel trap again. And basically, the only thing that's interesting is the race ends out is the fact that Marquez gets a track limits warning, which you're saying, well, potentially this could be a long lap if he doesn't settle himself down and get it together. But he does. So he wins the sprint. He beats Fabio DiAntonio, who climbed to second. Morbidelli is third. So it's a great day for VR46, right? Marini would be fourth, Aldeguer fifth, Mir sixth. So Honda has a great day, pretty much, right?
Yep.
Bezzecchi is seventh this time. And then Alex Marquez is eighth. And then Martin gets a point in ninth, having raced up from where he was back in there. So that's what happens in the sprint, which not a lot of great action there, would you say, Rich?
Well, I wrote a couple of things. I mean, very little to write about in terms of the race. I mean, although my opinion would change slightly the following day, albeit very slightly. I wrote in my notes, this track is not fit for purpose for MotoGP.
I agree.
I think I put it on a WhatsApp to you,
Yep.
and that it kind of, by comparison, it makes Valencia look like Phillip Island. That's how bad I thought the track was in terms of the MotoGP sprint. And I wrote, the sprint goes by very quickly. Thank beep. I won't say what I wrote down, but because it was, not an exciting experience.
No.
And you are left thinking, that's half an hour of my life that I will never ever get back.
I agree.
So, yeah.
It was terrible. I'm not
Happily,
gonna lie, it was
Sunday
terrible.
was a slightly better day across all three races, but
Sunday was a better day. So let's
yeah,
talk about
let's get to
Sunday real
that.
quick, and then we'll have a discussion about the track because that's a subject all to itself. But I think you need to kind of get the full effect of three races in before we talk about that. We do have some drama that's kind of happening here at the beginning. The Digia's bike, he finds a problem with the bike when he comes around from the siding lap to get out of the pits to get to grid. So there's a big discussion about what's wrong with the bike or what are they going to do and da 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 da. And so they're not sure what to do about it. And they actually are talking to, I cannot think of his name, I should have wrote it down, but the guy who's the head technical officer of MotoGP, they're asking, what is the rules if we take the bike off the grid? What is it if we leave it on the grid? What if we change bikes? What do we got to do? Da 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 da. Hey, Digia, what way do you want to play this? Because if we leave the bike here, we start from our position. If we take it off the grid, well, then we got to start from the back of the grid if we take that bike. So now you're going to be at the back. Oh, but if you want to, we could, basically swap bikes after the warm-up lap, then you'd have to leave by from pit lane, but you'd be at pit lane and not at the back of the grid. And all these decisions have got to be made, right? Digia says, well, I'm going to go with it. I think it's fixed. Let's just take it. Well, on the warm-up lap, some warning light comes on to Digia's bike, and Digia basically then bails for the pit lane. So he was going to get on the spare bike, which he did get on, and then he had to start from absolute dead last because he would receive a green light after the field had gotten through turn one, and then he would be released from the pit lane. So we had all that going on, which you got to feel sorry for Digia, right? I mean,
Yeah, because he was third on the grid, so that
he was
was,
third on the grid.
yeah.
He had a very good sprint race, let's be honest. And the boringness that it was, Digia did really well there. His teammate did really well too, right? So you're like, man, that kind of sucks for Digia. But for the 26 laps at the start, Mark, yep, he's into the first turn first. He's a little bit wide, and then Bez dives into that small little hole, kind of a la Dixon. So, you know, was Bez watching what Dixon did? That did, hey, I'm going to brake a little earlier, turn a little tighter, gas it up a little sooner. Everybody else is going to kind of want to run wide. And it, you know, Bez gets the lead. It's like, wow, that was not what I expected. I expected Marquez to have the whole shot and be done. Then that's it, right? So Bez kind of gets in there now, and basically they touch because the way Bez was going, the way he came into two, he had to roll off and he didn't have as much drive. Well, Mark had more drive from the way that he entered the turn. And Mark didn't expect Bez to be as slow as he was on the line, and they wind up touching each other. Now Marquez almost goes over the high side, having touched the side of, you know, the left rear of Bezecchi's bike with his right front, and he almost goes over the bars. I mean, not almost. I mean, it disrupted it, right? It stood him up. He caught it again. But that dropped him back to third. I'm like, well, now it's third and it's Mark Marquez. What do you think is going to happen now? Because it's a track you can't pass on, Jim. Okay, you obviously don't know Mark Marquez, nor were you paying any attention to the Moto3 slash Moto2 race, right? There
Yep.
obviously there is ways to pass, right? You just have to have some gall, but and go after it or whatever. But that's how we get through sort of the first few corners, right? So Bez is leading from Morbidelli, then from Marquez, then Acosta, then Aldeguer, then Luca Marini, and then Jorge Martin was seventh. So Martin got a really good start too, right? In the chaos of that first turn, Martin came out with it pretty good. Alex wound up going down at turn one, so he was down. I think he remounted and tried it again and whatnot. Martin had got himself to sixth. Then Mir and Raul Fernandez, they crashed together. So normal systems are resuming for Juan Mir. He's taken out by somebody else in a race. Or no, did he
No,
take out?
they
What?
kind of cr well, Fernandez crashed
Oh
in
yeah, they
front
had
of
separate
Mir, and
crashes.
but Mir just went down in sympathy. Now,
Mir went down sympathy. That's good.
was there something on the track? I don't think so. I think whether
That's
it was
right, because
just
they were
kind of
talking about
target fixation or whatever. But yeah, just weird. But they both kind of crashed completely independently of each other in the same place.
Yeah, sometimes you are using somebody as a marker. You do tend to do that. You follow it, you get that. Yeah, I totally forgot about how that had actually gone down. Yeah, that little twitch there. Now, Bez, for his effort, was trying to check out. Like, Bez was putting in the best laps that he possibly could to get through. And, you know, this is like on with like 20 laps to go in the race. And it's Bez. Mark's now second, right? He's taking care of getting through Morbidelli, right? That was like, boom, bang, thank you, bye, I'm going on. And you're like, okay, well, this is interesting. It's like now it's not a matter of if this is going to happen, it's when is it going to happen, because now there's only one person between Mark and the lead. But Acosta, in between this, now what moves to third, he takes it at the 8-9 chicane. But Mark tried to turn one, but he went wide. Bez still leads. He took the lead again, right? Then Mark tries to turn five, but he's wide. Bez goes back into the lead again. You're like, okay, these you to me, I looked at that and I go, yeah, okay, Marquez, I think they had a half a second or more, I think, in ahead of Acosta.
Yeah.
They were some distance up the track. Mark obviously saw his board. He knew Acosta wasn't there. These were trial runs to figure out where he was going to take Bez. Mark did not care one iota that he was wide, didn't care, it didn't bother him, didn't faze him. It was all part of the, I believe it was all part of the Mark Marquez training to get this right. You know, it was going to take some fiddling because he hadn't had to pass anybody like all week, right? So he
Yeah.
got to figure out how to do it.
But equally, fair play to Bezecchi as well for
Oh,
making a
yeah.
fight of it, because a lot of people could easily roll over at that point and just say, well, you know, Mark's on me now or just pass me. But Bez, he did this in Austria as well, if you recall. You know, he did fight back and made a fight of it for one or two laps. But I mean, let's be honest, we all know which way it was going to end up
Right.
ultimately.
Yep, I agreed. And, you know, eventually Mark does get by. He does it on lap 11 of 26. He gets by Bezecchi. He did it at turn one, turn two. You know, he got in deep enough, pushed Bez out, took the line, typical block pass, took care of it. He had business. That basically was the move of the race. He's now on his way to victory. Aldeguer would go down at turn one. Aldeguer was having a great ride again, right? A la Austria. And Aldeguer was coming, but Aldeguer misjudged the braking, lost it down turn one. Bez had a mistake at the turn 15, 16 chicane. So Acosta took advantage of that mistake and got by at turn one. So Acosta was now second, which were you kind of expected that to happen given what you'd seen from qualifying and all that, that, Acosta should have been the second man to Marc Marquez, and he was. And along the way, we had five to go. Zarco was down, and that was a very fast crash that Zarco had. He was down. Martin has now gotten by with five laps to go. Martin had gotten by Morbidelli to be
Fourth
fifth,
or fifth.
fourth, fifth there. But the race finishes with Marquez winning. Acosta's on the podium in second, which this is a really good ride from Acosta. I mean, given the adversity of what happened, the bikes that he damaged, for him to come second from where he was on the grid was really good. Bezzecchi would be on the podium in third. Martin would be fourth. Then Luca Marini fifth, which I was shocked Marini was that high. That really shocked me. I was really surprised. Marini is a good rider, but his days are probably numbered at HRC. To be sh
Yeah,
who
and I
knows.
think it actually that's a lot about how good the bike is starting to get, even accepting that it has some power issues, which is a crazy thing to say about a Honda, but they'll turn that around with this guy they've brought in from KTM, or who is coming from KTM, and I think tells you a lot of the reason why Martin was trying to break his contract to get on the bike next year.
It very well possibly could be.
Definitely coming.
Yeah, they're good. Honda's going to come good here shortly, that's for sure. Let's see. Morbidelli would sink to sixth. Binder is seventh. Paul Spargo on the KTM eighth. So you had KTM second. You had KTM seventh. KTM's eighth. That's pretty good for KTM, given where they started the season, let's be honest. Bagnaia got to a ninth place. Now, remember, I think he started 15th or 16th on the grid and got to ninth, which means that he had to be able to brake and turn and squirt out his acceleration. So maybe there is something. Maybe finally we have found the secret sauce that we've been waiting for Pecco Bagnaia to be good on his Ducati. I'm curious to see what happens in Catalonia. I don't think it's going to last. I think it's false hope, but I'm hoping because I'd love to see Pecco at least try to beat Mark.
I agree. I share your sentiment about hoping because we need Bagnaia in the mix. But look who was behind him in terms of, Quattro on a Yamaha that isn't working. Agüero, who, had a good couple of rounds at the beginning of the season, has had a bit of a mare ever since. Oliveira Rins on the Yamahas again. Alex Marquez, who had a penalty to serve in that race. And Didier, who started from the pit. So ninth, yes, but. And he. I think Bagnaia at some stage had a long lap penalty because he cut a chicane and didn't drop a second. So,
Correct.
yeah, I mean, ninth is not a great result for Bagnaia, full stop. But you can take some small crumb of comfort from it, I suppose, he finished. But, I mean, it's
Bad.
not looking good, is it?
Nope. So if we look at the championship, Mark has 455 points, which that is truly amazing. And in fact, I've got something else about Mark that is interesting statistics, right? Just because it's this way. If you look at his here, he has a 71.4% Grand Prix win rate this year. He has a 92.8% podium rate this year. He has a 92.8% sprint win rate. He has lost one sprint all year. All year. He has a combined win rate of 82.1% for sprints and the races on Sunday. And he has amassed 87.8% of all 87.8% of all possible points to be scored. He has 87.8% of them.
I'd love to see what his percentage of laps led for the season
I
would be
don't
as well.
I'm sorry, I don't have that
No,
one. That
fair
was
enough. But I would imagine
sorry.
it's well into the 80%
It has to
zone as
be.
well.
Yeah. So that leaves his brother 175 points shy. There are 296 points left for going to Catalonia. If Alex finishes like fifth or worse in like both of those rounds, Mark's champion in Misano.
Can be. It
Be
can happen in
he can be.
Misano.
It's very, very possible because Bagnaia is not going to solve this problem and delay Mark from winning the championship. Only one who can delay Mark winning the championship is his brother. And unfortunately, his brother has lost form, which Unfortunately, that's sort of kind of what happens with Alex. He's season goes on, he kind of makes small mistakes and then they multiply and they just just kind of fades away
The
a
bigger
bit.
problem for Alex Marquez is that his teammate's starting to show him up as well, who's a rookie,
Yeah.
let's not forget.
True. But do you rate Alex Marquez better than you do Fermin Ødegaard?
That's a really tough question, I
It
think.
is.
And
That's why I asked it.
yeah, no, fair enough. I mean, Alex Marquez is a Moto3 and a Moto2 world champion. So, I
That
mean,
is
it's not as
correct.
if he doesn't have pedigree. He certainly does. And I don't buy into all this stuff that he's only kind of got to where he's got because of his brother. I don't
No.
really buy into that wholeheartedly. So, do I think he's better than Aldega? I think Aldega's better than Alex Marquez. I really do.
I do too. I'm not gonna sugarcoat this one. I mean, look, if it was all about your brother, if it was all about his brother and his brother's name, right, then Tommy Hayden and Roger Lee Hayden would both be in MotoGP, right?
Yeah, that's a good
They
point.
aren't,
Yeah.
right? So it takes talent to get there. So, and if you're gonna get there, you're gonna get there on your own. Again, you cannot deny that Alex is a Moto. He was a Moto3 world champion and a Moto2 world champion. I was trying to think if he did it on a 125, but I think
No, it was Moto3. Yeah, he
it was
beat Rins,
Moto3, I
didn't
believe.
he?
I think he did, yeah. So, but I mean, he's not a slouch, but he's not, again, he's not alien territory like his brother.
And again, he's another of these riders that takes quite some seasons to sort of build the form. And he's certainly made
Methodical.
good on the form, so to give him his dues there. But Aldega's kind of what I would call an explosive talent, in the same way that David Alonso is an explosive talent and Pedro Acosta is an explosive talent.
I mean, if you think about it, if when Marquez retires and says, I've had enough and I'm done, and quite honestly, he could hang his helmet up anytime he wants now, and legitimately, he's going to still be probably the GOAT. But it is a tempting concept to think about Alonso, Acosta, Ødegaard all at the front and winning races. It would hearken you back to sort of like the 1990, I'm gonna go with like 1990 season. Lawson, Rainey, Schwantz, Gardner, Doohan, and any of them could win on any day. So,
Yeah.
hope springs eternal, Rich.
And the
Really
only
does.
constant is change. So, the markers won't be around forever. Nobody ever is. And what's good is that we can see all these potential goats coming through. So that gives you great cause for optimism as to the quality of the racing in the future. Let's just hope they sort out the bloody racetracks as part of that equation.
All right, since you mentioned it, let's get to the track, right? The track has been given a lot of flack over the weekend that it's unfit and unsuitable for MotoGP. I do not disagree with any of that, right? There were far too many bikes that went far too far into the wall. Oh, we didn't even talk about the most important part of it, right? Well, so Acosta's bike, right, almost gets a camera guy, right? I mean, by the luck of about 3 feet, the camera guy doesn't get hurt, right? Or maybe killed, right? But we forgot about in the race. I totally forgot this. Of course, you have a power failure and you got to restart again. You forget where you are. But the thing is that Bastianini falls in a chicane and he's sliding into the traffic that's going to be coming from what would be his left, right? He looks over to his left and I swear you could see the fear in his eyes that he was going to get nailed by somebody. And by the grace of God, everybody was around him. And didn't hit him because he was kind of being carried with the bike. I think his one leg was maybe kind of under the bike a little bit at the seat section, or he was at least close to the bike because I know he was going with it, right? If Bastianini had gotten struck, I mean, I don't know if he would have been hurt. I doubt that he gets away without a broken something, right? But if he got hit in the chest head on, that's potentially life-threatening there, right?
Even at relatively low speed like that was, but they're still heavy bikes.
It's a heavy bike, right? And it's blunt force trauma that's gonna get you. And the track is too short, too narrow. The gravel traps are too deep. The walls are too close. I think there, as Martin said in one of his emails, who is starting the petition to get us out of Balaton? Like, hey, Liberty, there's a couple of other tracks you could go to that are within 3 or 4 hours of where this is that would be far better to race a MotoGP bike on. I don't know the names of those circuits. I'm going by what I've seen Simon Patterson say on social media. But We've dodged bullets twice here. If you go back anymore, you're going to get somebody hurt and get them hurt fairly bad, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I said earlier on, I just think it's not fit for purpose, really,
No.
for anything outside of people going around on track days on 600cc bikes, for example. You know, I mean, okay, so as I said earlier on, 6 weeks ago or so, maybe a little bit less, but it doesn't matter. World Superbike was there, and the racing was okay. There was, I mean, Bautista had a big crash. I think I referenced it as we were kind of talking about this race coming up. He had a big crash at that turn eight, is it, where Acosta went down and had his whopper.
Yes.
Again, totaled his bike. It was a bit further around the corner, so it went a bit further, but it still hit the barrier. And there you're thinking, well, if a World Superbike can get there, then MotoGP is going to be even sketchier. And there was a lot of concern about this going into the weekend, and I think that for the most part that was borne out. What I just find hard to understand, and I don't know how much land was bought to build the track, but it's a brand new track, and for it to even be sanctioned for MotoGP, I can't get my head around, given how restricted the space is there, I can't understand how it even got through the planning stages, let alone the approval stages from a safety standpoint. So lots of question marks. I mean, for me, the Acosta crash and the ease with which that bike went airborne and hit the tower where the cameraman was. And as you say, Jim, I mean, a couple of inches of these aside, and you know, you might be looking at a dead cameraman there. I mean, he was an extraordinarily hearty fellow to sort of stand back, brush it off, put his thumb up to another camera, and sort of flag it away as if it was, oh, no big deal. I mean, I thought it was a big deal. I mean, fair play to
I
the guy,
did.
but they were bloody lucky that he wasn't killed. I mean, that's basically the short end of what we're saying here. And I would have thought that on that occurrence alone, they've got grounds to move the race somewhere else, just because it's not fit for MotoGP bikes, not the current generation. And I don't think the 850s will be much better, because the likelihood is they'll be going through turn eight quicker. So that ain't going to make the walls any further away, is it? If anything, they're going to feel a bit closer still. So I just don't think it's suitable at all. And as I said last time out, whilst you might say, well, World Superbike's okay there because they're a couple of seconds a lap slower, fine. Keep World Superbike and MotoGP separate at venues. I don't like the fact that we go to the same places. I just don't think it's good for either series. Create some differences, and that's one easy way to do it. And on a track as sketchy as that one, I just think you'd be looking at Kyle Army. I mean, I was talking about Istanbul Park again, as we've mentioned several times. Martin, I think, popped up on Twitter and said it's fallen into disrepair, not disrepute, disrepair, that track through lack of use and stuff, which is understandable. But with Toprak coming on board, I would have thought, you know, there could be some way to hopefully get it back on the calendar. And that would make an awful lot more sense than going a couple of hours up the road, because you've already got Brno, you know, you've got Austria, they're all pretty close to each other. Again, we talked about this last time out. So
No geography, Rich. That's a
it's a
rule.
world championship. Go somewhere much further afield. Because we've got, unlike some of the concerns around like Formula One, for example, where races in Europe are dying out, that's not a problem in MotoGP at the minute. So we could afford to go to Africa or somewhere else in Asia, or you know, lots of different places that we could go. And I just think, yeah, it's a boring track, it's dangerous. There's clearly nothing they can do to change it. I mean, let's not forget, a lot of the chicanes that are there were put in to slow it down and make it, inverted commas, safer, which it will have done in some ways, but for every action has an opposite and equal reaction. And that's the Bastianini kind of event where he goes skating across the chicane. As I said before we started recording, Jim, we see the same thing happening on occasion in turn two at Le Mans. That's the problem with chicanes. I wish we didn't have chicanes, but obviously they have to slow them down in certain places for safety reasons, fair enough. But those chicanes are so tight that a bike is just going to go sailing across and back onto the track, as we saw. And if a rider's there as well, as you said, he was very vulnerable for a couple of seconds there. And again, thankfully, nobody hit him. But that's not to say it wouldn't happen another time. So lots of people have been ranting about it. I'll say no more. I don't know what other people think. They can write in and let us know. But I can think of at least four or five other tracks that I'd rather be at than this one.
Name them.
Well, I've named two already.
Right.
I think, yeah, go on.
I would go back to the Nürburgring in Germany,
Well, I was going to say one of the
the
German
new one.
tracks. I mean, maybe Hockenheim would be a bit too sketchy, and it's you know,
Yeah.
the short Hockenheim, but probably the Nürburgring could be made to
I
work
think they could
because.
do something there. I'm not talking about the Nordschleife. I'm talking
No.
purpose-built track. Let's be honest. Let's be sure that we're there. I mean, there's a lot of talk about Spa trying to become MotoGP
I was going to
friendly,
say
and
Spa because.
sorry, Rich, I think that they're trying to do that because I think they see the handwriting on the wall that they're not going to be grandfathered in as a classic track that Formula One's always going to go to. Spa has had an on and off relationship with F1, and I think they're like, look, you have a they've got to a point where like we can't afford the fees. It's a great racetrack, no doubt about it. Would I love to see MotoGP bikes there? Hell yeah. You've got to, I mean, they did a lot of work. They moved a lot of dirt at Eau Rouge to make sure that there's runoff there. Now, they needed it for the cars, but they kind of did enough to make it, you know, are we halfway there to being able to do it? Do you have to have some sketchiness there for it? I don't know, but you could go there. I mean, you know, the thing of it is, we also complained that we were in Spain too much, right? So
Yes.
I applaud going to a different country, i.e., Hungary. Right, but yeah, there's, you know, I'd rather see them go to the Hungaroring where the Formula One cars are. I think it would be a better one.
Obviously, there's always politics and money involved in these things and regulations and stuff. So it's not just a question of going, oh, we'll go there instead. I do accept that. But for example, the track in India is great.
Yes.
That's fallen away, you know, as quickly as it appeared. So that's a shame because I know it was a severe challenge in terms of the weather and the location and blah, blah, blah. But that's one that's missing off the calendar. I mean, you know, think of the market in India,
Yeah.
you know, for selling motorcycles. It makes no sense not to be there. Okay, there are other considerations that are causing trouble there. I do understand that. So there are, I mean, okay, I was going to say Suzuka, which I, but I don't think Suzuka is necessarily any worse on safety grounds than. Than Balaton Park, really, from what we've seen, and they're running as with Spa, they're running the sort of the 24-hour or endurance 8-hour races at those tracks. So, you know, they are still at world standard, maybe not quite at MotoGP standard, but there are plenty of other tracks that we could look at.
We could go back to China.
We could go back to China.
I didn't
Yeah.
think that was a, that's not a half bad track per se. I mean, but whatever. I mean, if you're looking to add tracks, so I mean, I think you could go to Bahrain. I think that one would be safe enough, you
Yeah.
know? So there's plenty of money in the Middle East. They're gonna want to do something, right? I mean,
What is so bizarre, and we said this before we started recording, is that, you know, they had a blank piece of land
yeah,
to
they
build
did.
Balaton Park, and that's what they came up with.
Yeah,
I
that
don't
one I
understand
don't
that at
buy.
all.
It's a decent location. The lake is nearby. That lake is huge from what they said. And I get it. The land is as flat as a pool table. There's no elevation, so you're not going to be able to do anything, you know, super crazy, let's say. But you can look at the track in Thailand and the track in Mandalika in Indonesia. Those are right by the seashore. And they're relatively flat. I think Mandalika's got a bit more elevation to it than Thailand is. But Thailand is an interesting track because of the way they laid it out. There's, you know, some sectors that take some work and some effort to do it. And you could have done there. I mean,
They cover
I just
much,
don't
much
get.
bigger areas in terms of the land that they occupy, and I think that's key. This
Yeah.
Hungary
Again,
track
we don't know how much they
is
actually bought
very
or whatever,
constrained
but.
in terms of space, and that's the problem. So you've got the track sort of switching back on itself, and there's just no room for runoff, or not enough room for enough runoff, and that's why we saw what we saw. So yeah,
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, they've got a contract for the race to run there next year. It's on the provisional calendar, so. But as I wrote rather naughtily on an X or tweet, you know, I think how the hell are Liberty supposed to sell that shit? You know, because okay, you can make an argument that there were decent bits of the each of the races on the Sunday. The sprint was turgid nonsense. The Moto2 race was okay in the last couple of laps. Moto2 was okay in the last five laps, and there was a little bit of action in the middle of the MotoGP race. But really, other than that, it was pretty hard work to get through, as far as I was concerned. And I'm a dyed-in-the-wool fan. How the hell a casual viewer is meant to sit and watch any of that? It's just not going to happen. And that's Liberty's problem. How can you sell that?
Yeah.
I don't think you can. You need much, much more exciting races and events and locations than that.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Rich, but
Let's have a race at the Ridge.
yeah, they're making it better. The Ridge is getting better and better and better. And I mean, at some point I'm going to have to go out there and watch a Moto A race just because I think the It's a fantastic, it seems like a fantastic racetrack. I mean, you know, what if Flat Rock comes on and we get Flat Rock? You know, that one will be epic because that's up and down and around on the side of a mountain. Okay, not a mountain, a hill. Let's be honest about that one. But yeah, I don't know what to do. I mean, this is for the boffins at Liberty to figure out what they're gonna do and how they're gonna sell this. It's not our job to figure it out. We just want good racing on and competitive racing. And I don't think you're seeing really competitive racing in MotoGP right now. And I think it's not Mark Marquez's fault, right?
No, not
It's
at
the
all.
fault of the other people are not as fast as he is. And that tends to happen. Rossi, to go back to Gareth's email, Rossi understood the show. Well, I know I can win this one. I'm going to hang out here in third for a while, and then I'm going to, like, the last five laps, I'll get going. And I agree, Rossi did that a lot. There was many a race that Rossi just sat back, relaxed, chilled out, passed a couple people, let them pass him back, and I'll just win it this way,
Win at the
which is
slowest possible
fine.
speed, I think is what
Yeah.
Jackie Stewart said. And that's kind of
Jackie
what
Stewart
Marquez
said.
has been doing this year.
Yeah, I agree. Marquez is a changed person as far as after those first couple of crashes he had there at the beginning of the year, he has right at that ship settled it down and been like, okay, look, this is how you do it.
Yeah. I was slightly disparaging towards Rossi earlier on. And then last night, I don't know why it came up on my YouTube feed, but I watched the 2003 Australian Grand Prix where he had the penalty for passing under the yellow and did the whole okay, I'll just pull out 10 seconds then and I'll win it that way.
And I've said it before, I'll say it again.
Was the greatness of the guy. He could do it if he had to.
That could have been every MotoGP race for about 4 or 5 years. Rossi could have won every race by that distance, guaranteed.
Yeah.
Yet Rossi didn't. He knew the sh he understood the show. But that is the one time you saw Rossi race his heart out
Yeah.
to win because he had to,
And I
and
would say Valcom
convincingly put a
the following
statement
year,
down on
first
it.
race on the
Yeah.
Yamaha.
Oh yeah.
He knew that that was a pivotal moment in his legacy
Yes,
to win that one, to
especially after
beat
the
Biaggi
Ducati
on the Honda.
finesse
Oh, I
fiasco.
think, oh God, that was so good. So yeah, I mean Rossi was great as well. He really, really, really was. I just think he went on for far too long, and that's
Yeah.
in a way that's tarnished his legacy. And you have to go back and watch some of those early 2000 races, or even when he first jumped on the NSR 500, because he was really good on that very quickly.
Yeah. Yep.
Who can forget the Suzuka finger in the air going past Biaggi as a bit of payback for putting him on the grass? I mean, that was just classic. Anyway,
Yeah, we got to get out of this one.
we got to
We've
go.
gone way long. You'll have a monster edit there. So that's everything that we thought of for the Hungary Grand Prix. Love to hear what you guys have to say. Write us motopod@motopodcast.com. That's the email address, and we'll be more than happy to entertain you with thoughts and comments about all that. So ride safe, everyone.
And let us know if you're hungry for more. See what I did there, Jim.
Oh,
Yeah, that was bad.
that should be the title of this episode, Hungry for
Hungry for
More.
more? Question
There you
mark.
go.
There we go. That's the title. Sorry, everybody. We're sort of ad-libbing again. Yes, we'll see you next time. We've got a week off, and then it's Barcelona. Catch you next time.